ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I'm your host, Bill Brewster. I'm joined this week by Elliot Turner. I don't know what to say about Elliot except for I think he's the man. So that's my whole intro. I love him as an investor. I love him as a human. He's the man. So that's all I got. This is not financial advice, investment advice, or anything of the sort. We're not your fiduciary. Do your own due diligence. Get your advice elsewhere. This is entertainment purposes only. So with that out of the way, one of my favorite people in the world, Elliot, how you doing?
Doing great, Bill. Thank you. Too kind an intro. I could say the same right back at you, because what you do, how you share your learning, how you share and do it with integrity all along the way, it's awesome. I've learned a lot from how you've approached Twitter, the podcast world, everything, and it's been great to get to know you.
Well, I appreciate that, sir. I have learned a lot from you as well, and hopefully the listeners will today also. First thing they need to learn, let's talk about your days as a fish podcaster.
So, yeah, this was in the very early days of the podcast world. One of my good friends, who's now working at Google, at the time was working, I think he was at Digitas, like one of the big media companies, and he was tasked with learning about like new media and what it could all do. And this was, you know, 2004, I'd graduated college, started law school right away. On the eve of going to law school, I went to the Phish last tour concert ever in Coventry, Vermont. Drove straight from there to law school orientation. And I felt like there was a hole in my life. And I called it the end of my youth when Phish was giving up at that time. I was like, wow, I'm a grown up now. This sucks.
Yeah, that does suck.
And that's part of how, I mean, there's a song, Mike's song in Phish lore, where, you know, Mike Gordon's the bassist. And it's a song that he starts the lyrics with the words trapped in time. So our podcast was called Trapped in Time, like harkening back to how I, you know, longed for my youth, which was only 1 week gone. And so my friend was very, very well steeped in all these brand new technologies. I mean, he was also the same person who created my Twitter account several years later.
Oh, yeah?
You know, he really was like tasked with staying up on any emergent media. And, you know, we had to build the guts of the site. Like, there was no infrastructure that you could do podcasting on. There was RSS, which was a rail to share things. And you could see in the Internet Archive, you could look at our site. We even had to explain what RSS was. And so, you know, it was me and one other Phish friend and my, you know, digital tech friend together putting this podcast, you know, building it. And I think it was like our second one ever got over 20,000 downloads and crashed the servers.
That's crazy.
Of the site we had put together. And it was wild. Like, we got in touch with the Phish archivists who controlled, you know, the rights to their catalog. And they basically told us, you know, well, you don't have the right to do it. Just be quiet and don't tell us. And, you know, I think
that's kind
of
what
cool
you want out of that. Right. I mean, like, right? Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. And, you know, there's an angle there, like the jam band world. There's a great article, and I think it's Wired, about how the Grateful Dead really, you know, were at this nexus of exploring new media and what it could do for technology. So like early on, the Dead had a section in their concerts where tapers could come in. And, you know, taping sounds like so damn old school now. But once upon a time, it was like the really big thing. And these tapers would come to their concerts and they could, you know, set up their microphones and they could record a whole concert and they could take this tape and create thousands of copies and share it with their friends.
Oh, so they like were okay with the bootlegging?
And, you know, the Dead were the first people that used that bootlegging to tap into virality because I could make a tape.
Sure.
I could copy it and I could tell my friends, like, here, you go take this and give it a listen. What do you think?
Yeah.
When my introduction to the jam band world, actually, I think has a connection to this all. I went to a sleepaway camp in the Catskills in Pennsylvania, and one of my counselors, his name was Shoebox. Obviously not his real name, but everyone called him Shoebox. And why was this guy Shoebox? Because the entire underneath of his bed was his very neatly organized Shoebox collections of tapes of the Grateful Dead and Phish. And he wouldn't go anywhere without it. Like, this guy was allowed to bring like one trunk and one duffel. Obviously, he liked wearing dirty clothes because he was a dirty hippie.
Right.
He, instead of bringing one duffel of clothes with him,
Dead.
You know, he brought his duffel of shoeboxes of Phish and Grateful Dead tapes. And that was my introduction to that entire world. So like, you know, to pull it back, these people, this whole like sphere of the music world is very forward in how to deploy technology to tap into virality, to create a really organic connection with the audience, and to really kind of like feel one, even though you're not in the same place. Like I could feel like I'm at a live concert listening to some of these live recordings where you hear the audience, you might hear the guy knock his beer over and like laugh about it. And, you know, I mean, obviously it's not, you're not listening to it for a flawless sound experience.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's pretty neat.
And so we
created this podcast, called it Trapped in Time. And we really just wanted to like a combination of explore, you know, what could be in the web world, and tap into something that we loved experiencing in person. And it was pretty neat.
You were just a little early on the adoption curve of podcasts.
Yeah, but we had the eyeballs, so right?
20,000 listeners is legit.
Mm-hmm.
My dad, growing up, I used to get like all these envelopes from Japan. And it was all kinds of like Van Morrison bootlegs. Like he was just a diehard Van guy. But the weird thing is he never liked the Beatles. He always felt like they got Vans, whatever attention should have been on Van, they got.
Yeah, Van's the man, right?
Yeah.
My wife and I, our wedding song, Crazy in Love by Van.
Yeah, that's a good song.
Yeah, yeah, big fan. A lot
I
of respect.
Saw him once, the amount of instruments he played in like that one concert, it was crazy. I was like, dude, this guy is just like a genius.
Have you ever seen The Last Waltz?
Uh-uh.
Oh, man, the most epic Van Morrison scene. So he had stage fright. He was, like, scared of being in front of audiences most of his career. But in The Last Waltz, the band's last concert ever, at the Winterland, it was, like, Thanksgiving in the early 70s or something like that, Van Morrison wears a purple sequins jumpsuit and does the song Caravan and does these, like, running leg kicks across the stage, and it's one of the most amazing things ever.
Wow.
I love
I'll
it.
Have to check that out. The only
Last Waltz, like one of the great rock documentaries of all time.
All right, I'll check that out. I would like that. I'm sure my dad's seen it, but I'm definitely going to tell him to watch it. He'll love it. He does crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. Like he's flown to Europe to see Van play. He's seen Van. I hear like some of you Fish fans talk about how often you've seen Fish, and he's sort of the same with Van. How many shows have you seen?
God, I definitely lost count. It's upwards of 100. And,
what a monster.
You know, my pace has obviously tapered off a bit. But
yeah, between your new found podcast, financial podcast fame and, you know, running a fund and whatnot, I guess you don't have the time to always go around.
And the wife and kids.
Yeah, but that's like secondary, right? That doesn't matter.
Yep. Yep. I could work from anywhere these days, but it's also exhausting, man. I don't know how I used to do it. Like when I go to two nights in a row now of Fish, and now being like pre-COVID, obviously, I'm just wiped out. I don't know how I used to do like, you know, many nights driving from one city to the next, like hardly sleeping.
The young body can take a lot that the older body cannot.
Exactly right. So yeah, my youth did end with that podcast starting.
How'd you get to 20,000? Like back in the day, what were people downloading you on? Was it, because I'm thinking like, I mean, what year are we talking?
So this is 2004 to 2005.
Yeah. So what are people listening to you on? They're like downloading the actual MP3 and then listening like on their computer or whatever?
Yeah, exactly. So you download the MP3. You could do it either into iTunes at the time, or you could download it on your computer. And from iTunes, you get it to your iPod. Yeah. You know,
yeah, the one with the wheel that used to circle around.
Exactly. The iPod was such a transformational thing for me. Like I spent so many hours sitting at my computer, ripping my Fish CDs that I had. So like shoeboxes had evolved to my CD book. Yeah. And I was like labeling on certain ones that I knew I wanted to listen to a lot. I was like labeling the tracks one by one, like track tags didn't organically flow with the music at the time. So I'd have to label like which concert it was, which track each song was. And, you know, like these things are so easy now. We take it for granted.
Yeah.
And there's so many great resources. Like, I mean, Fish as a service is a thing, by the way. Like I subscribe to Live Fish Plus.
I love it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I'd imagine, like, if you valued that with SaaS multiples, holy cow, like, lifetime values of this audience are through the roof. I mean, I've been a sub now for, God, I mean, it's at least something like 5 years.
Yeah.
And I know I'm going to be doing this for as long as I'm alive.
Like, well, your growth is probably lower, but your certainty of subs is probably way stronger than the average business.
Damn right. Yeah, but they layer on new things each year. They have an ecosystem where, you know, like I'm buying some merchandise from time to time. You know, there's some special releases that I kind of like, you know, tap into my sentiments. So like, there's room to push ARPU up.
That's awesome.
There's some one-off purchases that happen. It's pretty amazing. If you follow the business models of these people, of the jam bands, they're like really interesting things. For a while, the Allman Brothers were doing a thing where with a ticket, like pre the days where streaming was really prolific, with a ticket on your way out, you'd get a CD recording of the concert.
Oh, really?
What Phish does now with your ticket, with the digits on your Ticketmaster ticket, after any show, you could go into Live Phish, and if you're not a sub, you could enter the ticket digits, and you get a free download of that show in either FLAC or MP3.
Huh.
So I think it's really worth following what this community is doing and what it means for like potential business models, potential opportunities in music. I kind of think, you know, any band with a large following should really be paying attention, because there's so many ways that you could really create like an organic relationship with your fan base, and where that relationship is not disintermediated by anyone. It's like you directly with your fans.
Yeah.
You know, one of the examples I really love is like during COVID, what Trey did on Twitch with 8 Friday night Beacon concerts, where on Twitch you could stream. He did it for free. Like the request was, you know, each night there was a different charity that he requested that you contribute to. And, you know, really
that's awesome.
Like personal meaning to each of the charities. And this concert, like, you know, it really felt special. It felt like you were part of something that was like, I mean, it obviously was, it was happening live. Like it wasn't just watching a recording.
Yeah.
And they also did their dinner in a movie series. So Paige would give you a recipe. He's the keyboardist. He would give you a recipe before a concert.
That's awesome.
And then they'd show something from their archive one night a week.
Huh.
I really think there's a lot that everyone could learn just like trying to see where they're going with things.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I didn't realize that they had done that. You know, the amount of connection that you can have now to the people that you like, I mean, whether or not it's a podcast or, you know, whatever it is, it's very cool. And I have noticed the people that like Phish have always told me that they've been like hyper innovative on creating fan experiences that, you know, maybe is outside what, you know, most people used to think of doing.
Absolutely. They've always been like really into that. I mean, think about the whole festival thing, right? Like when Bonnaroo started, I had to miss the first one. It was devastating. I went to the second two. And to think how it's evolved from the second one that I was at to now is just wild. It was really just like the misfits of society in some ways that were there in the beginning. And it was jam bands. Like it was filling a void from when Phish had done summer festivals and Phish wasn't around, right? The first one was when Phish was in their hiatus. Like, so you went from like Phish having toured for 20 years consecutively to stopping for 5 years. And it was in this void that Bonnaroo started, and it was really filling a void for a very specific community. But now Bonnaroo is really commercial, right? And there was a lot of disdain for that. I think it's even owned. It's owned by Live Nation now.
As most
like the
are.
Rights to it. This group CEG had kind of like proliferated not just Bonnaroo, but other festivals around it. And then you look at things like Coachella and, you know, yeah, I mean, all this stuff exists thanks to what started in the jam band community. And it's pretty cool. Like, I think it's really where a lot of the trends start, because they want to try something different. It's very experimental. There's a lot of trial and error, right? Some of my favorite quotes on like testing and learning, on putting yourself out there, knowing that you might fall flat, come from Trey or some like Mike Gordon has another one of my favorites on like, you know, failure being something that they're very willing to take, right? Mm-hmm. And it happens. And, you know, there are hard things that happen. I think one of the things that set Phish back in what's called Phish 2.0. So when they returned in New Year's 2002 to play through for 4 years, they played
that
after
Miami
that.
Show.
Yeah, the Miami
that
show.
Was when they
I was
returned?
At that one. That was the first time I was in Miami. It was
with the one that George Clinton
before
came
that.
Out.
The Miami show.
Didn't
that?
George Clinton come out that show?
Yeah, the
yeah,
P-Funk,
dude, I was
P-Funk
there too.
Was 12:30. It was the night before New Year's.
I was there too.
That was an epic night for me.
Yeah, that was
the
fun.
First set was amazing. They played L.A. Woman that night, which was really cool. They had never played that before in their entire catalog. I could get into the weeds on my fish, but the, you know, there was a point here. I think in Fish 2.0, what happened was part of what made them stop, I think. I mean, obviously there's the whole Trey got addicted to hard drugs, which was really bad. But there's also part of why I think he went down that route is, you know, they had always been very willing to take these chances and to put themselves out there and fail. But the fan base got so damn critical. Like they'd listen to a song that they played and they'd be like, oh, Trey flubbed this note at the minute 30 second mark. Like, I can't believe he flubbed that note. He's played it a million times. And people would just complain about, like, you know, find the smallest little error where they miss something and be like, ah, they don't have it anymore. And I feel like that got exhausting for them. And when they came back in 3.0, they're like, yeah, we're just going to have fun. We're just going to go out there. We're not going to be like listening to people and saying like, we're going to have to play certain songs. We're just going to go and like, we're going to do this because we want to do this, because we miss it, because it fills like a need for us. And we're just going to have fun and let it all out there. And when people say we messed up, who the hell cares, right? Yeah. And, you know, I don't think there's enough of that in the investing world. Like, I think improv has a big place in investing because a lot of it is like, it starts with core structures. You have these like basic foundational principles. So like a song, right? It has these basic elements and you start within a structure, but then you leave that structure at a certain point, but you leave that structure staying with certain themes that go through it the entire way. Yeah. And you don't know exactly where it's going to go, but you do know where it's going to end. To an extent. Obviously, you don't know perfectly because they do segue into other songs, but like you do have this core structure that you're going to stick with. And in the middle, you're going to really be experimental and you're going to explore and you're like tapping into an uncertain world. And, you know, I think that's a lot of what we do. I think I wrote in my letter something to the effect of the job of a securities analyst is to make decisions in a world that's inherently unknowable.
Yeah.
Right. We don't know exactly where the world's going to go. We are making decisions in a field where uncertainty is the name of the game.
Yep.
But we have to anchor ourselves in certain realities. And that's just like improvisational music to me.
First of all, I want to commend you on your transition to investing. This is why you're a podcast professional, because I was thinking to myself, OK, we're going to have to transition here. Something that you said that I've been thinking about a little bit is, you know, the job of a securities analyst, right? And sometimes I think of myself now less of a securities analyst as I do like a true, you know, a business analyst, right? And like the question isn't the curate thing. Sorry, people, for continuing to talk about it. Like that was more of like a securities analyst hat that I had on in that, right? But most of what I do now is trying to figure out like where a business can go and the interplay of the competitors. It feels to me like it's less of a, is this security mispriced, and more of a, you know, where can the business go that the market doesn't respect? Which obviously, you know, if you're right on the distribution of outcomes, then you're correct that the security is mispriced. But I almost feel like more of the alpha, I used to think that it was like in the footnotes, and that's like table stakes. I'm not trying to say that it's not required, but I don't think that that's like my perception of reading and finding a mispriced security was maybe either incorrect or I've just changed the game I play. Does that make sense?
100%. And I totally think of myself as a business analyst first. But the one area I'd riff off of that to invoke a musical term there is that I think, you know, this past month has been a great reminder that securities analysis itself does matter in terms of understanding how positioning is structured, like understanding who's invested alongside with you. You know, in curate, you don't really have to think too much about that. That's part of the appeal to an extent. Like, you know who owns most of it and it's good. Yeah. But like paying attention to positioning, knowing if positioning is really stretched, if there's a big short interest, understanding why it's there and what they're looking at. And, you know, just trying to get a feel for just broader situational awareness. I think it's something that, you know, you don't want to leave totally aside.
Yeah,
I agree. If you have too much fast money in a certain stock at a given time, you got to expect certain things. And then, you know, the other side of that also is like when you know positioning and you know it's being squeezed in certain places, you know, one of the things I was doing over the last couple of weeks is obviously paying close attention to the Melvin 13F, the Maple Lane 13F, and trying to get a sense of like what positions I have that have overlap, what positions I'm interested in that have overlap, and where there might be selling pressure or buying pressure that I might want to sell into because I might be short for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And I did find one outstanding, like I knew one of the positions I had that I wanted to get bigger in was a large position, but it's smaller market cap than the other Melvin and Maple Lane names. Both of them were in it. And it just got smoked. And I knew exactly where I wanted to step in. And I was able to buy a lot more size than I otherwise would have because, you know, I was so clear in understanding that this was a non-fundamental seller. Yeah. That this was someone who was a forced seller who really liked the position, but obviously had to sell. And, you know, I wanted more. So I was able to step in. To me, that's like where the securities analysis layer above just business analysis could really come into play. Yeah. And that was really what I spent a lot of my time trying to do, like just be ready for which situations I wanted to kind of make a move on.
I didn't miss it, but I waited to get like a little greedier on some stuff and then it sort of ripped, but whatever. I was like looking at anything that was like really bombed out, but yeah, I think when I bought TransDigm and man, I mean like Liberty Sirius, all that stuff in March of 2020, right? Like that, you could see it all explode on the same day. And it's like, okay, mm-hmm. there's no possible way that all of these things happen to be explode. Like, I mean, you know, it's got to be forced liquidation. It cannot fundamentally, these are not correlated assets. And, you know, to the extent that the world collapses, you know, then your equity exposure is a more important question than sort of like, which equity do I own if everything sort of goes down? So I do agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember full well a mentor during the financial crisis saying the end of the world only happens once. So if you're going to bet on it, I mean, what's the point?
Yeah, that's right. I think what I think people missed in March, and you know, maybe it's just dumb luck that you know, or naivety or whatever that I was able to not panic or whatever. But you know, 09 was a liquidity issue, right? And this time, that really wasn't on the table once the Fedzuka was launched. Jim Cramer mm-hmm. went nuts that one night. He was like,
yep, exactly.
He was so excited.
I mean, I think there's something to be said about how, I mean, think of the financial crisis in improvisational music terms, right? No one really knew. Like, there was no playbook for exactly what to do. There was a rough paradigm coming out of the Great Depression. And we were so lucky that Bernanke, who is one of the foremost scholars of that era, kind of had a sense of what the playbook should look like now. And he was creative and he deployed tools that otherwise I think any other Fed chair might not have. And so coming into the COVID crash, you know, the Fed had a pretty clear sense of which tools were really valuable and which tools worked, and they were able to do it with speed.
Yeah.
And I think that made a big difference, you know? I mean, even think about Bernanke. He was a little hamstrung early on. Cramer had to egg him on.
Yeah, that's true.
He knew that he had a sense of the tools. He had published more. I remember going back to, there was a talk he had given while at Princeton about what tools Japan should be deploying and drawing the distinction between qualitative and quantitative easing, which is something that I think has been lost on us.
What is it?
Lost in history. Yeah, qualitative was more about easing the quality of balance sheets in the private sector. So it would be stuff like buying MBS at the Fed versus quantitative, which was geared more toward interest rate policy. And I don't think in hindsight anyone makes that distinction anymore. We all call it QE or facetiously QEfinity or whatever it may be. But there were real thoughts behind these policies and how they could work and why they would work. And they sure did, you know, and I mean, saying as much about Bernanke and FinTwit might sick the trolls on you. That's a different story. But we were really lucky to have him there. And, you know, in March, I think Powell really understood. I don't think he was one who was too keen on some of those playbook items at the start either. But I think he definitely appreciated how they did work in the end. And, you know, I think it's very different to be a sideline critic than it is to be the one with the ball when the game's on the line, yeah. Right? It's very easy to say someone should have done something differently when you're sitting there behind a microphone, but it's when the buck stops with you, I mean, and you're making the decision, thank God they listened and learned the right lessons, I think.
Yeah.
Makes a huge difference. I mean, it's very easy to say in hindsight that March was an ultimate buying opportunity. Hell, I raised a lot of cash. Part of it was a function of like, I had a big position in financials going in, and I'm like, God, I do not want to fight ZERP again. So I hit sell, and I was like, I'll think about what to do with this money later. Yeah. I have no interest in holding these things now. Who knew how things would play out, how things would go? One of the things that I was thinking about very recently, like in March, I was like, okay, you know, 1 month, we'll get past this and move on and go back to our lives.
Yeah, man.
And even then, even thinking that, I still didn't know what it would look like for financial markets. Yeah. But if you told me we'd still be in like this balance between lockdown and free up, and COVID would still very much be a thing, and yet financial markets are like by and large okay, and we fully transition our economy to this pseudo hybrid digital model, you know, one of my initial thoughts was, yeah, perhaps this is like a general strike and 80% of our economy will very much work and things will be largely okay afterwards. Put out a letter very much to that effect. But I was wavering at points. I was like, I don't know. Is this really going to all come together, right? But I think part of, to tie back to part of being a securities analyst, it's like one of the things you do want to do is you want to make sure that even in the worst of times, you could stick with your highest conviction ideas. And one of the things that happened to me is like my highest conviction ideas, actually my conviction went up during that period. I became more confident that, you know, as I saw us truly transition to digital world, as I saw what I was doing, what my peers were doing, I knew that a very large chunk of this could very much work. Not all life stopped.
Yeah.
You know, it was different. It was hard. It was stressful. Holy shit. Having kids at home while you're trying to deal with, like I never imagined dealing with my first crash as an actual portfolio manager, being with no daycare, no school. My wife's work is similarly busy because she's got a similar like inverse correlation with markets and work activity level. And it's like, how do we stay together as a family, not all lose our minds, have the kids like not feel that their lives are falling apart too, because we went from having a lot of activities for them on a regular basis to doing absolutely nothing. Yeah. That was definitely, I mean, we'll reflect back on moments like this when we're a lot older, like shaking our heads, like, how do we do it? How do we do it? I don't even know.
I moved.
Right?
That's how seriously I took it. I don't want to be revisionist in what I say about March. Like, I didn't know at all, you know, the outcome. What I did have a sense on something like TransDigm was I knew how much cash they had. I had a sense of how much they were burning, and I had a sense of how long I thought that they could last. And then my next question was, if this analysis is wrong, does it even matter, right? Like, the world doesn't matter. If you know, that's what I say about the equity allocation. You and I talked about, like, I was a net deployer, but I also was trying to manage my liquidity because I don't have like an income stream. I mean, I'm eating off what I kill in the investment book, right? So it's like, okay, well, how am I going to manage? I tried to keep myself at having roughly a year and a half to 2 years of expenses covered. And then I tried to deploy everything in excess of that. And my bet was, if a year and a half can't help me, or if that's not enough, then it's not going to matter. Like, then we're all going to be looking for jobs, and whether or not I know how to invest is really not going to matter, which, you know, maybe that wasn't smart. Maybe it was, I don't know, but it's interesting. So I'm in Charter, right? And that's like a levered cable entity. And to go from, can people pay their cable bills, to, wow, that's a super stable and necessary business, you know, in under 4 months, is crazy. And the other thing that's weird is, you know, when I was thinking of some of these things, I'm like, okay, well, maybe I could make 10% off this for 5 years. And boy, wouldn't that be great, like, given the facts. And then here, it's like a golf ball off of a, you know, street. Like, half this stuff is, you know, I mean, a lot is doubled. It's crazy. And then the speed at which stuff bounced back, I never could have predicted.
Yeah, same. I was preparing for hard times to last for quite a long time in equity markets, knowing that there would be like tremendous opportunities amidst it all. But the speed is really impressive. I think it's reflective of the speed with which the Fed came in, right? Yeah. The speed with which stimulus got out there. That was the fastest we've ever had stimulus get out there. And it's kind of wild to think, you know, you can't prove counterfactuals, but there's no way this happens without having massive intervention.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I do. I'm not convinced that we're out of the woods. Like, I'm very interested to see how some of these businesses perform over the next 3 to 5 years. The one I'm specifically thinking of right now is Starbucks. I look at that and it's just like, I'm going to be interested to see the same store numbers for the next 3 to 5 years, because I really think a lot of people's habits have permanently shifted, and it's introduced, you know, coffee at home. I know people that have bought coffee makers that are not cheap, and now they sort of like their cup of coffee at home. And I don't be interesting to see how long people stay out of offices, the whole fleet. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to watch.
So I've been working from home for like almost ever, not for 8 years.
Yeah.
And I had just gotten an office in March of 2019. So I lasted like 1 year in an office. And now I'm back from home. I blame it on me. I've given up the office. Maybe one day I'll get it back again. You know, I think something like Starbucks is probably a little more resilient because, you know, life moves on, right?
Oh, yeah.
There are a lot of Starbucks in airports. There are Starbucks near every office. I do think a lot of stuff's going to go back, but I think there's going to be like a different everything's going to move to a new normal is very much what I think.
I think the business will be fine. Don't get me wrong. I'm just interested to see the security returns.
What I was really nervous about, and I'm still to a big extent, is like commercial real estate.
Yeah.
Because not only is commercial real estate like a pretty large asset class in its own right, but there's a lot of leverage to it. And they're like cascading levels of leverage.
Yeah.
So like each player, you know, you go from the actual property owners to the CMBS owners,
yep,
to some of the banks and other shadow banks. And it's like all this stuff, every layer is levered. And what happens if it all, like the bottom edifice, the bottom of the ladder kind of falls down a little too hard. But I kind of think it'll come back, like just from knowing what it's like working from home for another year. It's like I do want to have the office experience again.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I might not go in every day like I did, but at least 4 days a week, I definitely want that. It's good to have separation and removal. I hardly leave the end of my driveway these days. So like
it'd be nice to go on
gonna be a little more
little
keen
drive
to broaden my radius.
Yeah, no doubt. I agree with that. Something that you were saying earlier, you were talking about like floating things out there and being public and embracing some of the, I guess, the risk of failure in that. And it reminded me of something. I don't want to bring up something that's too painful for you, but your Grubhub, you know, pitch going south. You know, it was interesting to sort of see that happen because you were riding, if I'm not mistaken, you did PayPal and Roku the year before. Is that accurate?
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, here are like two positions that are really winning. And I sort of felt like when you pitched Grubhub that people joined on your pitch without doing their own work like quickly because of how right you were on PayPal and Roku for the right reasons. And then I felt like you got like really unfairly blamed for people's lack of work or their own conclusions. What, I mean, from your perspective, what was that like?
Yeah, okay. So I had a lot of thoughts about that. The first time I wanted to pitch Grubhub, I had been preparing the presentation for the Wide Moat conference, which is like late spring.
Shout out to Manual of Ideas, by the way. The reason you and I are friends. Thank you, John.
Right, exactly. We met at Latticework New York the last time it happened. I can't wait till the next one. Crazy.
Yeah, I'll be there. I'm probably going to go across the pond for one, too. I might be at a couple of those things. He's going to have a
good backlog.
I should
be in Switzerland right now. Last year, this week, I was there. Yeah. And it was like one of the best powder days of my life.
Yeah, that I saw those pictures, man. That was the NARPOW, so to speak.
Uh-huh, it really was. We got like 3 feet over a day and a half.
Ooh, shredding the freshies.
It was amazing.
I love it.
So yeah, Grubhub. I was going to present that in June of 2016. And so I'd first bought my shares. I'd started my position. And I don't know if people remember, like the beginning of 2016 started with the markets down basically every day, January into February.
Yeah,
and
that's
really
right,
like I made my most transformational moves as a manager. I think I became myself as a manager instead of trying to be someone else in that time. So I bought pretty heavy into 3 stocks in that period, which were Grubhub, Investnet, and what was at the time Priceline, now Booking. And, you know, Grubhub was like my favorite of them for so many reasons. That same time I started Trapped in Time, when we were recording, we would order, and you could blame it on a certain thing, we would order like 3 times from Seamless Web, which was brand new at the time, like dinner, deli sandwiches, and then dessert while we were preparing, recording, and like packaging all this stuff. And like Seamless was so mind-blowing to me. Before, you could only get like pizza or Chinese food delivered kind of easily. And now all of a sudden you have this way online where you could order anything that you wanted. And so that was my introduction, right? Right out of college, coming into Manhattan, going to live in Manhattan when Seamless Web was brand new. And I'd followed the company from that point forward and had been really excited for it to IPO. And I think it was late 2014. But, you know, I am a value guy at heart, and the price was way too rich for me in 2014.
Yeah.
And I have this affinity for like busted IPOs, for stocks that come public.
Oh, yeah.
Have a little too much enthusiasm.
The post-sleeper, or post-hype sleeper, right?
Yep, yeah, the post-hype sleeper. Yeah,
I like this
I think
concept.
That's one of the things that you and I connected yeah. over, because I used the Cubs and Javi Baez as the ultimate
Love
example for
Javi
post-hype
Baez.
Sleeper in the baseball world, in the fantasy mm-hmm. baseball world, in my presentation of Grubhub. I made it all about Chicago, I think.
I appreciate it.
Not knowing that it would be right after your heart at the time.
Still is. I love that city.
Yep, there you go. So, you know, I'd wanted to present it in the spring of 2016, and then the stock like blasted off way quicker than I ever had. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that maybe influenced me a little too much in not looking critically at certain angles of it. I've learned a lot of lessons from that position. But, you know, I bought my shares at 18 and the thing was at $150 within a year, which is just insane. And I'm like, okay, well, I sold a bunch. I didn't quite sell enough, so I learned another lesson on selling. I wanted to wait until the calendar year rolled.
Yeah.
And the stock halved yeah. before the calendar year rolled.
Taxes, man. They can yep. cause some stupid decisions.
Yeah. One of my good buddies calls it tax derangement syndrome.
Yeah.
He's like, anytime a manager falls for tax derangement syndrome, get nervous. Hmm. And he's an investor in me, so I take that to heart and listen. And I've kind of like pushed that aside. I think it's important to be conscious of taxes, but don't let it influence a decision,
yeah.
right? And I learned that lesson with Grubhub there. But, you know, I still liked the company and I still felt there was an opportunity. I still had some of my position. And then it kept coming down. And, you know, fast forward 1 year and it had gone nowhere. And that's when I was like, okay, I finally had my chance. I'm going to pitch this in the wide moat presentation. And, you know, I had put myself out there. I think it was about $65 a share when I did the presentation. So it had gone from 18 to 150. All the way back down to like the mid 50s, and then it settled in the mid 60s when I did the presentation. And around that time, I also got into a little Twitter dispute with Jim Chanos over it. I thought it was good fun, but he ended up blocking me for
oh, no.
that. We have since patched up.
That's
and
good.
We've had good conversations in direct message.
That's
so
good.
Thank you, Vitaly, for getting Jim to unblock me. And thank you, Jim, for being open-minded to listen to someone who you once thought was a fool. I appreciate that. Twitter's amazing.
Yes, it is.
Anyway, got to throw that in there. So I had presented Grubhub, and obviously riding the coattails of Roku and PayPal, I think the way to break down their financial models is very similar. When you think about the drivers for their revenues, each of these companies have one line that's the number of users, which you multiply by the level of engagement. So on PayPal, it's transactions per user, right? Roku, it's hours watched per household. And in Grubhub, it's orders per diner, right? Multiplied by something like their average order value, right? In Roku terms, that's ARPU, which includes like a couple other things. I'm not going to get too lost. But each of them have three core pieces that flow into their revenue line. And I think a lot of people latched on to the similarities and the successes in the first two to say the third would similarly work.
Yeah.
Now, you know, at the end of the day, when things were at their worst, I got an email from someone in the middle of March 2020 saying, "Fuck you, Turner. I can't believe you led me astray." It's like, I'm out here. I'm not here to like lead people. I don't want that to be what it is. Like, I'm putting myself out there because, you know, one of the best things that happened to me when I presented Roku, the amount of feedback, both critical and supportive, was really phenomenal, really helped shape how I think about things. And when I say supportive feedback, I don't mean the echo chamber being like, yeah, I love Roku. It's like, people who had done deep work on certain elements of the business were like, yeah, this is the work I've done. I'm going to open my book to you because you've been so generous putting yourself out there. And here's some information that could help you build your thesis, build your conviction. And, you know, let's just keep an open dialogue and share with one another.
Yep.
And to me, that's the value of putting myself out there. And I think it went a little wrong in Grubhub. You know, I think that's one of the things that really I've latched onto how that works, how that influences people. you know, I did another presentation recently, and I decided that this one, I don't want to leave the confines of the Manual of Ideas community as a presentation. Like, I want that to stay there because I know in MOI, I'm tapping into a network of global professionals.
Yeah, there's an understanding.
Right? But the feedback is so valuable to me. People will find flaws in my work and be like, look, you're not thinking about this right.
Yeah.
Take this approach and it'll help you. And, you know, I know some people who say, like, when you put yourself out there like that, you have this commitment bias and might overstay your welcome in things. That might be someone else's personality. That's not mine. I could change my mind on a dime. Yeah. And I know I'm open to that. And, you know, I've gotten way more good than bad out of being out there. But I think if you're not willing to put yourself out there, it's probably because you're not confident enough in your own idea.
Yeah, I want to just like soften that a little bit, just because there are people that really worry about commitment bias. And you know, for some people, I think that that is legit. But I completely agree with you. I think I've been struggling lately because I think I do a little too much media, right? Like, and I think that Buffett and Munger would probably say, why don't you read a little bit deeper? I guess that the one thing that I would say back to that, though, is the amount of, like, what I get from these podcasts, I get people that contact me with, like, their best idea. And I get people that hear my ideas and contact me. And I try to respond to the ones that are thoughtful as much as possible. And it's been an incredible network to build. So for me, like, you know, I read about it. It's interesting that you brought up, you know, like trying to be somebody else early and then becoming yourself. Like, for me, part of what I got gifted in life is a personality that people seem to like. So why would I not use that to my advantage? Like, that's insane to me not to do that. And I'm not Buffett and I'm not Munger and I could never be them playing their game. But I have found, like, my ability to play my game and try to give back in the way that I think I can. And that's worked.
I think that's what each of us has to do, right? Recognize our own strengths. I think Munger very recently said something to the effect of too many people try to just copy us without using their own thoughts. Yeah. Like, one of the things I'm most proud of is I don't think anyone could look at my portfolio and say, I've seen another like it.
Huh. Yeah, that's
like,
cool.
This portfolio is so uniquely me. And there's a common thread behind every one of these ideas. But, like, I don't think there's anyone else out there who thinks exactly like I do. And, you know, I don't think there are enough people who think like that. Like, when I started, I did feel this need to try to find, like, 50 cents on the dollar bargains or, you know, really, like, the traditional value stuff, even though I always had, like, a slight penchant for growth being part of the equation. Growth and value are tied at the hip, right? We could repeat these quotes as if they're, I don't know, they've become cliche almost.
Yeah.
And,
but wait,
you know,
can
one
I just
of the
stop you real quick?
Because
this
about,
is important.
I started.
Hang on.
With that.
I just want to stop you real quick because this is important to say to, like, not so much the pros that listen, but the retail people. When you hear, like, Buffett and Munger say something, you really need to think about what they're saying because there are things that they say that on the surface, I heard and I was like, oh, this is the answer. And as I've now put in like 8 to 10 years of real thought about this stuff and like 5 professionally, I go back and listen to the stuff that they say and it's got a completely different meaning. It's not even close to the same thing that I thought they said. So I don't mean to cut you off, but I think that that's a really important point.
It's huge. I think it's a big deal. And, you know, I mean, it's important to reflect on the fact that Buffett in the partnership days was not the same kind of investor as Buffett now. But that alone isn't enough, right? You have to think like, well, to what extent are some of these changes reflective of deploying that much more capital and doing it in a structure where he does have cash flow always coming in? Whereas, like, when I, in a fixed portfolio, want to buy something, I have to make 2 decisions every time, right? I have to decide what to sell and what to buy. For Buffett, I mean, he's always got cash coming in, so he doesn't have to think about what to sell. And, you know, decision fatigue is real. So, like, the more decisions you make, the more likely you are to make wrong decisions. And when you make one wrong decision, it can psychologically lead you down a path to making bad decisions. So bad decisions beget bad decisions. And, you know, I think...
Yeah, man, you get in a slump.
Yeah,
that stuff's real.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's also like the poker element of going on tilt.
Yeah.
You might not know it, but psychologically, you might be not coming at things from the right mindset.
Yeah.
And I saw a manager, what did him in was this decision that, like, you know, he was struggling for a little bit and he decided, like, I don't want to find good compounders anymore. I want to find home runs.
Yeah.
And so when you start swinging for the fences, like, that's not the right approach either. Like, you have to have a tried and true approach to yourself.
Yeah, that's right. At least in size, and at least for me, I don't know. It may work for some people. It would not work for me.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of it. And saying that is recognizing, I think, one of the most important things that for me really matters. Like, your approach has to fit your personality.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of what investing about is gearing your approach toward maximizing your conviction in your good ideas.
Yeah.
So if you know you could fundamentally come up with good ideas, like if you trust your process that you could do good business analysis and generate good ideas, your job as a portfolio manager then is to position yourself to see through your best ideas, even in the worst of times.
Hmm. I like that. That's Todd Wenning said that about David Gardner to me. He said, like, his one of I don't want to put words in Todd's mouth, but I'm pretty sure this is an accurate representation of what he said, that one of David's superpowers was the ability to take like a huge hit and wake up the next day and say, you know what, I'm going to go find the next Amazon. Right. And like, mm-hmm. I don't think I have that in me. I'm not great at taking haymakers. Right. So I tend to be very like downside focused. The reason I talk so much about David Gardner is I've sort of wondered if part of the reason that I'm so reticent to take a hit is I have sort of like bought into the concentrated book narrative, and maybe tweaking that a little bit could reduce some overall risk in my sort of like way that I run my life. And I could still capture, like, I think I'd be more willing to bet on something like Roku a little earlier if I didn't say, okay, it's got to be 5% or 10%. Now, the flip side of that is I can't just have a bunch of like 1% positions and reduce my hurdle on the business quality as and sort of use position sizing as an excuse to do so. But that's what I've been thinking about a lot over the past 12 months.
First is like, you know, for my personality, at least, I'm very even keeled and, you know, don't get too up or too down. So I could handle these punches. Grubhub was like a pretty big punch, but I tend to do my best work when that happens. Like, you know, it sharpens the mind, not the opposite, which helps me. But, you know, I understand everyone's a little different. In terms of structuring my portfolio, though, I am hyper aware of my flaws. Like, I constantly am focused on the fact that I could get things very wrong. And so, you know, I think that's reflected in I go for what I call semi-concentrated, not concentrated investing. Hmm. And, you know, I let concentration be an outcome, not an input. And I concentrate on those ideas that I know so well that I could understand real deeply. Yep. And to tie it to Roku, like, I started small, but there's something to be said about recognizing the duration of an opportunity too. So it was important to me in understanding, like, Roku's something that's a little different. Their opportunity, you know, and I'm tapping into my 2018 mindset when I was first really working on the name. When it was in, you know, I was watching it go from, I tried to buy the IPO. I didn't get shares. And then it went up to $60 and crashed to $30 within the course. So it IPO'd at 14, went to 60, and then crashed to, it actually bottomed at like $22 or something. Huh. Within 3 months of having hit the mid 60s. And that's when I was really, really diving in. And, you know, I was thinking about this thing has a very long runway. So I could start small.
Yeah.
And I could, you know, give myself room to kind of piece into this if it comes down further because I really believe in the opportunity, or to, like, several years down the line, there will be another chance where it's going to hit a rough patch.
Yep.
And I could get much bigger then, but I really understand the business. I love it. I don't want to miss it. I want to be a part of this and I could get involved. Now, when I first bought my shares, when I finally had the position size I was comfortable with, it didn't go up for the next 15 days for a single freaking day. And then to start the year 2019, I remember counting the days. Its average range in the month of January was 8% on a given day.
Wow.
It only had 2 days in January of that year. I'm recalling off the top of my head. I could be off by a couple. It only had 2 days where it didn't have a range that was 6% or less. And so this thing was really volatile. Freaking volatile.
Yeah.
Just absolutely insane. But there are a couple things that I'd say about that. One thing that I've learned in seeing these growth stocks through several cycles is that the more volatile they are, the more Mr. Market is expressing very clearly the range of outcomes here is huge, right? That is the market saying, like, you know, there is a really, really wide tail on both sides, right? But there's a really big opportunity if you truly get it right.
Yeah.
And if you're wrong, you're going to get kicked in the teeth. You're going to get run over. You're going to lose a lot. But, you know, that should factor into how you size your positions and how you do your analysis, right? Yep. How deep you have to get to truly have conviction.
Yeah.
And something like that.
I guess I want to make sure that I'm like clear on what I mean about the Roku thing, because I fear that it came off a little wrong. Like, what I mean is, to your point on trying to be somebody else, for so long I was so focused on, like, you can't predict the future, therefore you should discount the future, therefore you should find what is cheap today. And if I was more willing at the time to sort of like open myself up to, hey, you know what? There is a range of outcomes in the future. And to just like not even accept that, it is sort of like stupid, right? You're really truncating the tools in your toolbox, right? So I think I probably would have been better served taking smaller positions when I thought the future was knowable. For instance, the biggest error of omission by far was when I got the first iPod. I should have bought some Apple stock. And all I heard in my head was Buffett saying, you can't predict tech. No matter what, don't, you can't do it. You can't do it. You can't do it. So for probably 10 years, I just like, this is one of those things that like, I just listened like a lemming and I didn't think for myself, and it cost me a ton of money. But you know what? I deserve that pain and I hope I never forget it.
I bought Apple then as a know-nothing investor. And I sold it, and I was going to buy back, and I was waiting for the day that Steve Jobs would leave to buy it. And I put in a bid. I think it was at like 82, and it never got there. And this is several splits ago. But, you know, that was a formative lesson. Like, if you want to own something, just own it.
Yeah.
Like, you don't need to be perfect.
Well, and I mean, you and I we see Naked somewhat similarly. I think you're a little bit more there on like where it's going. But without learning some of those lessons, I don't think I would have gotten comfortable in that idea. And whether or not it works or whatever, I just, it is sort of part of my evolution as an investor, where it's like, okay, well, I do think that this is a product that I really care about. And I like, I am a user. I really like it. I do think they have some problems. So maybe it's not for me a huge position, but to me, the range of outcomes warrants at least some position. And, you know, hopefully that's a positive evolution. We'll see in time.
Well, the one thing I'd attach to that is, I think even Buffett said a quote about how it helps to be an optimist, right? Yeah. And every one of the problems is an opportunity.
Yep.
So if they check off each of these problems, like, it's not about thinking about where the product is today.
Yes.
It's about where the product is going to be in 5 years, and whether they have the resources and the know-how and the execution ability to get there.
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely something that was hard for a lot of people with Roku at the time I bought it too, because it was still majority hardware business when I bought it. So like, a lot of people didn't want to see the platform side of things, right?
Didn't you buy it at like 3x platform revenues or something like that?
What's that?
Didn't you buy it at like 3x platform revenues or something like
that? Yeah, I was very confident. I was buying it 3x 1 year out platform revenues.
That's so cheap.
3x 1 year out platform revenues. And now it's trading at 30x trailing. So, by the way, when we were talking about range of possible outcomes, this was not in the range that I was contemplating. Yeah. Like, I had a feeling something good could happen. I never thought something this good could happen this fast, right? So that's important to put out there. I'm glad you reminded me. That's a caveat I want to put out there. Like, I didn't fantasize something this great. But one of the things that I did really hone in on was, you know, at the time, the average viewer was watching about 2 hours a day. Average viewer, I should clarify. The average household was watching 2 hours a day on Roku, who had Roku. Meanwhile, the average household is watching upwards of 8 hours of TV a day. And to me, it seemed clear that 2 hours was going to 8, no matter which way the world went.
Yeah. That makes sense.
And so, you know, so long as Roku could maintain their market leadership position, that too was going to 8. And by the way, we're not even at 8 yet. So I still think there's upside in engagement, right?
Yeah.
And that's something really important to me to think about. Like, you know, think about where the product's going, what's going to be there. To me, it was inevitable that everything we'd watch would be available on CTV. And so, you know, again, to tie it to the value world, right? I don't want to untether from value. I was very conscious of value. I was paying 3x forward platform sales.
Yeah.
And to me, that meant they just needed a 20% margin on their platform in the out years. And considering in years where they're aiming for break even and they're putting up a 10% margin, I was like, okay, if they try to not make money and they're at a 10% margin,
yeah, then 20% they should be able to make money.
Very achievable if they actually wanted to make money.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I could really tether that to my kind of value DNA at the end of the day. I didn't have to, I could fantasize like, yeah, you know, 8 hours a day from every household, it's going to be phenomenal. But I didn't have to go too far over my skis. And that's something I'm still not willing to do, right? Like I could look at Shopify today. I wrote in my letter a lot about how my miss in Shopify informed my investment in Roku and led me there. That's a good story in its own right. But like I could look at Shopify today and be like, I love this business. By the way, I use it. I have an e-com store that I have played around with a lot. And I know everything about how Shopify works. And I love it. And there's not a single bad thing I could say about Shopify. Toby's the man. But I cannot underwrite to these prices, no matter what sort of like uplift I want to give them in their ability to penetrate higher take rates with more vertical services they offer. Like, I just can't get there. I'm a value guy at the end of the day. I could love the business, but there's not any price I'm willing to pay.
Well, this is how stocks get ahead of themselves, right? It's the grain of truth that gets taken too far. And then people look back and they say, well, my biggest mistake ever was selling. So rather than like tethering something to fundamental projection, I'm just going to assume that this will always outperform whatever I'm going to say. And there's no price too low. And, you know, that's fine. Shopify is going to be a great company in the future. There'll probably be a chance to buy it. I hope I'm smart enough then. Because I looked in December of 2018 and I'd passed, and that was so stupid. But, you know, whatever. Not the only dumb decision I'll ever make.
Yep, exactly. I passed. I view every day from when I first passed as a pass on Shopify and a mistake, right? Yeah. Every morning I woke up, I made the same mistake again, which is incredibly dumb.
That's true. That's true.
But
it's not just one single decision.
Thing on Grubhub, because one thing that's important to me that I think also is relevant to where Shopify is today, like I'm a little more willing and comfortable paying up for something if I know there's strategic asset value to it as well. So like Grubhub did not go well from the day I presented it to the next like 6 months, but it was bought out at a decent premium to where I presented it. And the actual return was better than the S&P.
There you go.
So obviously, the shark sucked, relatively speaking.
There you go. So fuck that guy that said, fuck you, Elliot Turner.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't
or
easy
girl.
To see.
I shouldn't assume it was a guy, but I bet it was a guy.
I bet it was. I think you're onto something there. But, you know, the hard part with it is like, you know, you don't know exactly how it's going to happen. But the way I view some of these companies, like when I bought Roku, I was like, well, if they just stay here for a while and the trends in CTV continue as is, someone's going to have to buy them.
Yeah.
And that's going to be true whether the price is lower or higher because they fit a need for so many people in different parts of the ecosystem.
Well, it's your second way out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is huge.
I view it both. It's two ways out, though. It's a put option that you own and it's a call option.
Yeah.
Because if things are going well, someone might buy them for like a nice premium early and pull forward a lot of your IRR. If things aren't going well and they go down, then the vultures are going to swarm and be like, yeah, I'm going to buy this to fulfill a strategic need.
Yeah.
And with Grubhub, we know that there wasn't just one. There were two interested buyers. And I bet there was a third that was lurking out there. So Uber was much closer to buying it. And then Takeaway swooped in. One way or another, they were going to get bought. And so I think that's important. That's an important part of my analysis in these two. They have to be small enough that they are swallowable to fit a strategic need.
Yeah.
And I think that's important when you think about these companies. Like you can't be $150 billion market cap and have that same sort of setup.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. You know, it's funny going back to what we were talking about, putting ourselves out there and the benefits. Like, I can't even begin to tell you how stupid I would be if I never did this stuff, right? Like, if I never joined Manual of Ideas and I never started on Twitter and I never tried to sort of like open myself up to, I'm okay with people telling me that I'm dumb, I'd still probably own like Cliff's Natural Resources. You know, like when I started this thing, man, I was like going through Sears and I'm looking at how Eddie Lampert has not returned anything to the, like the fundamental common shareholder in the minority interest has not gotten anything out of Sears in forever. And somehow I'm still trying to figure out how it's cheap. It's like, what are you doing? And it's funny. I actually reached out to somebody that I had talked to, you know, lots of years ago. And he's like, oh, you still looking at stuff like Sears? And I said, no, I've moved on from stuff like that. Although, you know, shout out to the GameStop longs. They caught a bid.
Yeah,
maybe
right?
Not for the right reason, but it's still a bid.
Sears is another thing too. Like, I think there's this big affinity, and I have it, for like owner operators, but Eddie Lampert is not that. I think that was like some of the Buffett halo, like Business Week had him on the cover as the next Buffett, and they're like, oh, you know, we got this next great investor who's running a company.
I bet his fund, I mean, I'd be interested to see his fund returns, because they were leaning up a lot of those assets in favor of the fund, but I don't actually know. Thankfully, I haven't spent
the time.
He's
got great stuff in there too. I mean, I think AutoZone is one of the ultimate case studies in how someone with the financial mind could enhance operations as well and could create tremendous value. I think it was from the period of 2000 to 2015. They were one of the 10 best performing stocks in the entire S&P.
Yeah.
Maybe even broader. Maybe it was the Wilshire 5000 that they were one of the 10 best stocks. And really all they had was like low to mid single digits top line growth. And by extending working capital and repurchasing a ton of shares, they showed that that playbook could lead to phenomenal success in financial markets.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd give a ton of credit to Lampert. Like, I don't want to make it seem like I'm knocking him for Sears. Like,
well, they just didn't do that right. I mean, it was obvious to anyone that would walk in the store that they just weren't running the right playbook.
Yep.
And then the shop, yep, whatever exactly. That app they had, if you downloaded that app, it was pretty obvious that that was wasted money. So
I don't even pay attention to it, to the point
I'm
where
telling
it
you, I was like trying to convince myself. And then I just said, what are you doing? This is stupid.
Yeah, well, maybe it's the Chicago thing, too.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know. I for a long time, I wanted to be the smartest guy in the market. Now I just sort of realize, like, there's a lot of reasons that you don't have to try to be that. And I'm not, so why would I? So you
give yourself a little more credit than that.
I think I'm reasonably intelligent. I was going over my returns. I'm pretty proud of, like, what I put together. But I've got a long way to go. The nice thing about investing is I don't think it ever stops.
I was going to say, if anyone doesn't think they have a long way to go, then they should quit, because, I mean, no one, Buffett and Munger haven't given up learning, right?
Yeah, they've been like really positive role models. I wish I could have dinner with those guys, but I'm not alone in that request. Who were you trying to be when you started? You said that you were trying to be somebody else. What was your version of an investor that you thought was who you should be?
Yeah, it wasn't like a one person per se. It was just like, I really wanted to be like true value and find 50 cent bargains. Like, I wanted to be able to say for sure that something was worth more, and I'm just capturing that spread.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that's a good way to invest. I think there's a lack of humility with it, right? Like, the market's smart. The market knows how to price things.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I mean, the inflection for me was really being introduced to Michael Mobson's writings. I think it took me like probably 4 years longer than I should have to truly internalize it and, you know, go all in on that. It's one of those things that happened like slowly, then suddenly. And I'm like, this is the way. But I just had such reverence for these value guys who could like so confidently say, like, I know this is worth more.
Yeah.
Like the smartness that you're talking about. And I wanted to be one of them. And, you know, I think, geez, it's just so hard to frame, because I think there's some truth to like, yeah, sure, certain things are worth more than they are, and you can do deeper work than someone else and understand like the value. But I've learned that the deeper work is actually on a totally different dimension than I thought it was coming in. So when I thought it was coming in, it was like what you said, reading the footnotes, and it was massaging the numbers in different ways. And, you know, it was very quantitative in nature, but the deeper work to me that I've really learned pays off more than anything else is the qualitative work.
Yeah.
It's building a network of experts in different domains who you trust to give you the right information about whose product is best.
Yep.
It's like an obsession on customers and why customers interact with the business and what drives them. And so unless you can tap into the mindset of a customer, you know, there's not much that you can do with it. So the deeper work is just on a totally different playing field than I ever conceived. And once I made that transition, like, I think it really started to show up in what my portfolio looked like. And it started to show up in like my ability to not just buy Roku, but I own it today, right?
Yeah.
Like in the past, I probably would have gotten a quick return. And I know some people who came in early with me and, you know, we had a $30 average price. Some people were like, okay, this thing's at 45, I'm selling.
That would have been me.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things
that I did with Apple, I think I sold it for like $1.2 trillion, like an idiot.
And by the way, if you do that over and over again, you're not going to make money.
Yeah.
Why? Because the risk was that Roku could drop 50% before it ever went up 50%. And so if you're going to ring the bell on the plus side every time, but you're also going to bow out on the risk side, you just had a 1-to-1 risk reward,
yep.
Right? You go into it saying, okay, I'm willing to take 50% risk in this because I know I can make 3x my money on it. And then you sell when you're up 50%. You didn't truly buy the risk reward,
yeah,
that you said you bought on the way in. You tricked yourself and you got out without actually achieving what was the framework you laid out for yourself there.
Yeah.
And you could do the mathematical proof, but if you do that over and over, right, in the Kelly, you know, you can apply Kelly criterion and approach that framework. If you do that over and over, you are going to just lose money.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you are right.
That's one of the hard parts with the market, by the way. Price is there to tempt you to do the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. That's where it goes from being a business analyst to a security analyst, because price is trying to act on you. It's not just as benign as Mr. Market's there to like shake your hand and do business with you in a grumpy or a happy kind of way. Like Mr. Market is trying to manipulate you. He's trying to toy with your brain. He's trying to like lead you to make decisions that you don't otherwise want to make. And the hardest thing to do is like try to take the step back and not let price act on you. And that's where I think there's this paper I love by Shlomo Ben-Artzi and Richard Thaler called Myopic Loss Aversion and the Equity Risk Premium. Might have gotten one word wrong in the puzzle in the name.
That's
but
okay.
Effectively, they try to study like why should an equity risk premium exist?
Would they,
right?
Would
like
they
why
come
wouldn't
with?
Why wouldn't an efficient market arbitrage that away versus bonds, right?
Hmm.
And they're like, okay, the obvious answer in EMH is that it's volatility. But that's not good enough. Like, why should a premium exist over a very long period of time?
Well, I mean, you've got, you are lower on the cap stack, right? So you should have some additional compensation.
Yeah, but like, why should that exist in perpetuity, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I've been thinking about some of this in a similar way. Certainly, like, the equity of a quality company, I think, should probably trade inside junk bonds as far as like a spread to the treasury. But then like the equity of something like, you know, my beloved Cleveland Cliffs, despite how much I love their CEO, probably should be outside of junk bond spreads.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you this much. Ben-Artzi and Thaler have a totally different answer.
Okay, they're probably right. I'm just a guy.
Who knows, right? You can't prove it. It's one of those things that like there's no counterfactual. You can't prove it, but they say it's people look at price too much. And it's, you know, it's tied to volatility insofar as volatility is price that's trying to act on you. But they say if people looked at price a little less, they'd be a lot better off in the markets.
Yeah, I think that's almost certainly correct. That's
right.
Yeah. I mean, I think about what am I fundamentally trying to do? I'm trying to own a group of companies that can help me be wealthier down the road than I am today. So like if I have that compilation, who cares if it's bid a little bit too high today? And like, for me, if I underperform going forward with the book that I have, which I don't think I will, obviously, but that's could be endowment bias. Like, I'm still going to own some really good stuff down the road. I don't think, like, I'm not going to starve owning what I own. And that, I think, is more important than, like, oh, is this stock a little bit too extended for what I do, right? If I was a hedge fund guy or I was running, you know, a ton of outside capital for people that demanded the highest possible return all the time, then I couldn't run this strategy. But my strategy sort of, hopefully that's the outcome. But as of now, that's not sort of the design, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I was going to say, but it's funny. I mean, I talk about him all the time, David Gardner, but for so long I discounted the Motley Fool because I saw it as like so retail and sort of like below me. I mean, I hate saying that out loud, but it is how I thought, right? I was like, Buffett is the answer. Value investing is the only way. Like, what is the Motley Fool? They're just kind of like writing crazy stuff. And the more I've studied it, the more I see genius in it. Same with Ron Barron. Like, that guy, you know, he maybe is one on one name that I think is sort of overly hyped or whatever, but he might be totally right and I might be totally wrong. It's impossible to look at his career and tell me that the way that he thinks is not valid. Like, you can't win that big over and over again and not have a framework that works.
I really don't understand why Ron Barron does not get more respect in like the FinTwit circles, in the professional community. I 100% agree with what you said about David Gardner as well. Like, you know, there's something to be said about how, like, when you're a professional and you read an average Motley Fool piece, you're like, that doesn't have the sophistication that I'd want out of, you know, covering this name. Insofar as it's retail, it's very accessible.
Yes.
Analysis, but it's a way more robust framework and thought process. And I love the phrase spiffy pop.
Yeah, spiffy pop is good stuff.
In the investing world.
I haven't had enough spiffy pops, man.
Yeah, it took me till Roku was actually a 10X to have a spiffy pop in it.
Good for you. For those that don't know, a spiffy pop is when it pops as much as your cost basis in a day.
One of the best all-time terms in the investing world. Yeah. And I think it's fun. It's hard. Like, you're not going to get many of them ever.
You got
to be very right before you even have one of those. And also, the portfolio that David Gardner builds is tough for a professional investor, right? Yeah. Like, he knows he's got cash coming in. He doesn't sell anything.
Yeah. He's right? The interview, like, I want to do more than any. No disrespect to any other interviews, but like, I have a lot of questions for him that I
want you to do that too.
I know, man. He won't do it yet, but hopefully in time. And it's not him. He's just got a rule, but I got to get him to break it.
Yep. Yet is the key word.
Yeah.
You will.
I know.
You have this way of making it happen.
Well, I think it would be a really good interview. Like, I think he would benefit from it. And I think people would benefit. And I think fundamentally, like, who he is, he cares about educating people. I know he'll say yes eventually. It's just got to happen.
Right. Yeah. No. And that's, I would love to see Motley Fool get more credit and respect in our circles. I think there's this hubris that doesn't let certain people respect them.
Yeah, well, there's like a desire to find something that's like very intellectually elegant or something like that. And I think that the real intellectual elegance there is how simple it is. But it's just because it's simple, it's really freaking hard. Like, I don't think most people are wired to run the kind of portfolio that he runs. And that's why I think his returns are so good.
Yeah, well, people in FinTwit are more inclined to fawn over something like Fannie Mae Preferred because it sounds genius and it's an asinine idea. It's an investment in a lot of respects.
Why do you say that? It sounds like you've gone down this rabbit hole.
And by the way, I've dabbled. Yeah. At one point in time, I dabbled in a very small slice of it.
Yes, you speak as though a man who knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it just sounds so freaking smart. And by the way, you and I both came to investing from law school first.
Yeah.
So like, you know, I come from a law background, have an understanding of the relevant laws. I knew eminent domain was like a crock of shit in approaching that anyway. Like, that was one of the areas I actually paid attention to in law school. But it just sounds so like, first of all, it's asinine because like, who in the world wants to bet on a political process leading to an outcome that's anti-populist when populism's rising, yeah. right? Like, what is Fannie Mae Preferred's getting value other than the transfer of immense value from the government to the private sector? And what, like, systemic purpose does it hold? I don't know if any, like, none of the people bringing these cases are the actual people who are aggrieved, right? It was actually community banks who got hosed on this. It's not these hedge fund managers bringing this case. Just look at what's happening right now with GameStop, where it's like they want the pitchforks against hedge fund managers. Yeah. And you want just like a government giveaway back to these people for, you know,
yeah,
it's what not may have been seemingly rational reasons, but not really truly like objective legal reasons.
Yeah.
I don't know. But yet so many people love that idea and thought it sounds brilliant. And the same people would like speak so condescendingly about David Gardner, like, oh, my God, look at this guy just buying Netflix.
Yeah.
I just kind of don't get it. It's one of the frustrations I have with some of this stuff. But
dude, I was that guy until really until last year. And Austin Lieberman, as different as he and I see the world, he said something to me that clicked. And he's like, I don't like how you value guys talk down to people and how you think it's the only way to accomplish a goal. And I really did, like, part of me was said, no, I'm above that. And then I don't know, like, I reflect when people say stuff to me. And I said, yeah, you're right. And then I started to study. And that dude Matt Cochran and I have become friends. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, he is. He's a great guy. And he's really helped me sort of, like, piece together some of the things that my brain sort of didn't put together in the puzzle. So I'm glad.
Yeah, we connected over PayPal. He does great work. He goes deep.
Yeah, he does.
He's writing a Motley Fools for retail. Like, I mean, he goes deep and he really knows his stuff, does awesome work. 100% agree on like the condescension. I'd be remiss to not point out that you are destroying Austin in your bet, though.
It's true. And I enjoy that very much.
Still room for some value. So
that's right.
I have to put that out there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I still lean one way, right? But I was overly dismissive of another way of thinking. And that was a mistake.
But see, I think it ties back to this point about personality being really important. One thing that I think I've done well from early is I've always been appreciative that there's no one right way to make money in markets. I started at a trade desk and like the person who taught our course was like, you know, most of you are going to fail, but every single one of you who succeeds is going to have a different approach than one another. And it's going to be reflective of what you do best and who you are as a person. And so, you know, I really internalized this idea, like, there's no one right way. And I think a lot of value people would really benefit from learning how other people make money in markets, yeah. how other people have built approaches that are scalable and repeatable, that actually do in fact work, that benefit them. Like the most underread book I'd argue in the entire value world is Alchemy of Finance by George Soros. By far the most underappreciated in terms of like how to think about, you know, there is specific stock analysis in there. And it's a framework that's really valuable. The section that's the alchemy of REITs, I think, is really interesting to think about, not just in terms of REITs, but in terms of where else you might see the same phenomenon playing out. And also, he talks through in his journal in the second half of the book, every decision he made during key periods in markets. And you can get a real lens in how to manage risk, how to manage positions. And it's like that sort of stuff is like there's so much hubris in the value community where people don't actually look or think about thinkers like that. You know, and I think it would really, really be beneficial to a lot of people. So, you know, I mean, if there's one takeaway for me here, it's like, fine, don't listen to me that I know the answer. Listen to me where I can help direct you to find the answer inside you.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. And then once your portfolio reflects who you are, I think you got a reasonably good shot at doing okay. And if nothing else, you can stick with it. And for me, that's like the number one reason that I started doing this is I was like, man, if I do something that I don't believe in and I bail at the wrong time, like I am going to ruin my family's future.
Mm-hmm.
So now I just got to figure out how to compound wealth fast enough to keep
at least if you go
to keep my wife happy with the house we're building.
Right.
Which is going to be quite a pull on the old AUM, for lack of a better term. Something that's an interesting thought about, like, you know, the portfolio reflecting who you are I don't think that there's too many people out there that would have Berkshire and Curate as their biggest positions and then adding Twitter. And I can imagine my value brethren saying, what has gone on with this guy, right? But I know that, I believe strongly that I can run that portfolio better than I can run somebody else's, right? So it's right for me. It may not be right for other people.
It's very uniquely Bill. And I think that's one of the most important things, right? Again, Munger told us that we should, you know, be unique, be different, think for ourselves. Like, how could you do anything other than that? And I know at least with one of them, you could truly tap into the customer's intent. Like, you know.
You're talking Curate, right? Because I'm an old lady or totally ordering everything off the internet.
Exactly right.
Yeah, that's right. I'll have to ask other people about Twitter. We'll see what they tell me.
Yep. So, no, that's like one of the awesome things about you, though. I mean, you know, a lot of it is about having a portfolio that is different, having a portfolio that's unique. How else do you try to find alpha in the market other than, you know, I'd say, again, for me, like, I think no one has my portfolio either.
Yeah.
And that's one of my strengths, you know? Or at least I think so. I like to think so.
No, I think it's pretty objectively true. When do you mind going through sort of like how you came to Twitter? Like how that idea, because you used it for a long time before you liked the investment case.
Yeah, so let's talk about how I came to Twitter from two angles, right? First is like how I actually got to starting an account on Twitter.
Yeah.
And then the next is like how I really warmed to the stock. And it, you know, I think the second part is a three-step journey in a lot of ways. But part one, how I got started on Twitter is that I was obsessed with Google Reader. I had a group of friends who we'd share things constantly on Google Reader. And when Google announced they were getting rid of Reader, my same buddy who started the Trapped in Time podcast was working at a large media buying agency. And at the time he was like, you got to check out the site Twitter. It's freaking amazing. And I didn't know what I was doing. So I created a Twitter account. And, you know, at first, the only thing I did was I was blogging regularly. And I hooked up my blog to like auto send a tweet saying when I created something new. But once Reader was destroyed and deprecated, I started sharing interesting things. I found FinTwit and it became like a two-way street. And, you know, I kind of break down Twitter users into three buckets. There are the lurkers as one bucket. There are the broadcasters, you know, the people who are there not to like engage and communicate, who are there to like spread some kind of message, and they might follow like zero or one person, usually themselves.
Yeah.
And then the third are the people who really want to immerse and be part of the conversation and have, you know, this two-way kind of like I feed in and I take out. Like, I'm here to learn and I'm here to share what I have. I'm here to put ideas out to be destroyed as ideas and kind of refine them. And I just, you know, got totally obsessed. And it's obviously a key part of how we met. And then, you know, how I got to Twitter the stock. I mean, I don't know if people realize this, but I was actually bearish on Twitter the stock before I was ever bullish on it. And I thought it was an obscenely overvalued IPO, as much as I was like obsessed with the product by the time it did go public. The way I break the world down, I thought it was going to be really hard for the company to justify those valuations for a long time. And so I tweeted out several like bearish, facetious, like this thing's a bloated pig kind of tweets for a while. And, you know, I think the big thing for me is like before it was even obvious why they had problems, like it was valuation, right? And, you know, by the way, I don't short much. So like that's not really part of what I was doing. I just like, you know, I felt the valuation was too high a hurdle. But like what really like when the valuation started compressing, I was like, the fundamental problem for Twitter is they don't know who they are and what they're good at and why they exist. And so, you know, I really wanted to see, for me to get interested, a pathway to Twitter acknowledging what their essence is, why they're there. And, you know, it took Jack coming back and saying, like, let's get rid of all this other stuff. And, you know, like in hindsight, people might say, like, oh, well, they should have stuck with Vine. And I think that's kind of, you know, the wrong perspective. Get rid of this other stuff, focus on our core and define ourselves, you know, and build around an essence. And so I think that was step one of me getting interested. When they IPO'd, I had written down on paper, when the stock gets to a $10 billion enterprise value, that's when I'm going to be interested. Sure enough, that valuation corresponded to when they started figuring out who they were, who they are. So that was pretty nice. So, you know, I was able to get involved for the first time. And, you know, I mean, maybe I'm in Jerry's team, never sell, but I kind of like starting small with these companies, especially when I see a really long runway. And to the extent that Twitter was possibly what you'd call a turnaround at the time, I didn't really think so. I think it gets back to that saying, like, you know, from Buffett, like, you want a company that any idiot uncle could run and it's still working.
Yeah, well, that, it's not quote. That exactly, right? There's a lot of social issues that they encounter.
Absolutely, right? They had big problems. They had big fundamental problems that they had to attack. And, you know, not long after Jack came back in, I do think, like, the whole safety stuff was kind of essential and core to the mission of making Twitter better, but it was also a distraction from solving some of the problems that it had. You know, it actually led to some of the problems compounding.
Yeah.
And problems being, you know, Twitter wasn't built as Twitter. They were built as a gateway to communicate through SMS. And they, you know, the site that's twitter.com was an acquisition. Twitter didn't create it themselves. Their ad stack were like five different acquisitions slapped together.
Yeah.
They had no good platform, no good foundation. And so, you know, I mean, when they had to work on safety first, in contrast to fixing their foundation, you know, it was important work. I think it absolutely translated into like reigniting user growth, but it wasn't necessarily good for the business, for like being able to kind of experiment, iterate quickly. And, you know, the ad stack just couldn't really do anything that you'd want a modern ad stack to be able to do. So, yeah, I mean, the second part of getting interested was really getting more interested, taking it from something that was like, you know, an average size position to the biggest bet I've ever made in my career, was this idea that I truly did a lot of background work and came to fully buy into the belief, even before it was a narrative that they put out there, and I think they could have communicated better, that they just didn't have the right foundation to succeed and to tap into what we wanted them to do as users, to iterate quickly. I also think there was this cultural fear to kind of experience the wrath of the power users. They didn't want that, right? Like the decision, everyone talks about how long it took them to go from 140 to 280 characters. And if you recall, the day they did that, I mean, people were going nuts. They're like, what the hell are these guys doing? Yeah. Why they do that? And now no one talks about it.
Yeah. Yeah, so. It is interesting. It for me, I mean, I just disclosed that I got long today, so I'm paying quite a bit more for the business than you are. But it's just impossible for me to look at the decisions that Jack has made. And I mean, you know, it's easy to Monday morning quarterback a decision when you don't have the decision to make. But this guy has taken a step back in the middle of being thrown into the most important conversations in the world and basically rebuilt his business and his tech stack from the ground up, right? And said, like, mm-hmm. We don't have the business, we don't have the foundation that we need in order to enable the business to get to where it needs to get. And we're going to focus on like the really important community health stuff first, right? And then we're going to worry about the business. And now they're like through that. And I just needed to have a conversation with myself. And thankfully, Dave Kim, Scuttle Blurb, shout out to you, called me and, you know, sort of was like, we were talking about it and just thinking about like where that business can go if there is a closed loop within the ecosystem. I don't know. I understand how people can be like, you're paying too much. That's fine. Like my out year forecast is way more bullish than yours. I mean, that's what it boils down to, right? Like I fundamentally think that business could be something really, really important, especially for the power users.
I think one of the cool things about right now with Twitter, when you think about where they are, for the first time in a decade, I'd call it a blue sky like ethos at the company. They are forging unforged territory. Like Twitter was a known entity, but once you add in spaces and the ephemerality of fleets and you add in review and newsletters, like to use Jack's quote, that gives them a lot more surface area.
Yeah.
And there are a lot more, I think, you know, once again, like when you think about like complex systems, they talk about this phrase emergent phenomenon where there are like effectively you have a platform and you don't know what the best future uses are going to be.
Yes.
And you could dream and you could start thinking about things. Like one of the awesome things I think about with space is like some people ask me, is that just a COVID phenomenon? Like when COVID's over, is that going to be a thing? And I'm like, hell yeah, it's going to be a thing. You know what? Like even before COVID, when my Islanders make a very infrequent playoff appearance, I'm sitting there in my freaking text messages with my Islanders crew being like, yeah, and, you know, they're not hearing me scream or anything. Yeah. I envision us sitting in a space together and going absolutely nuts and, like, experiencing every moment of a game in a way, you know, like, obviously I'd love to be with them, even, you know, talking pre-COVID times, I'd love to be sitting in a room with them. But I got kids, a job, you know, I got things at home. Like, most of these games I do end up watching planted on my couch.
Yeah.
For better or worse, you know, that is what it is. But, like,
well, that's the life we have, man.
Yep, exactly right. Exactly right. But then I see other things.
It's not ideal for watching sports, but it's pretty good for everything else.
Right. There you go. And, you know, I could see stuff like sports rate. So, I mean, I'm obviously stuck in sports because that's just, I think about where I'd use it most. But, like, sports radio is a big thing. I mean, my dad listened to sports radio on his commute every day for, like, 50 plus years, right?
Yep.
I can imagine sports radio being, like, exponentially better and more interesting and more engaging in spaces.
Well, dude, you know what's cool is I've gotten into Clubhouse a little bit. And what's fun for me is I'm able to sort of, well, not sort of, I mean, I'm able to engage with fans of this podcast. And it's it's fulfilling to me. I think they enjoy it. They pop in sometimes. So I hope that I'm, you know, adding some
And you're
value.
Saying they, not me, because I have a freaking Android phone.
That's
and
true.
I can't.
But that's, we can't help you, sir. If, if you haven't switched from green yet, nothing is going to make it happen.
Nope.
But, you know, it's been really cool, and I think that one of the interesting things about that format is you can have a service, right? Like, I'm stealing this thought, but I'm not going to cite the person that I'm stealing it from, but it's not my own. So if they're listening, I know it's you, and you know it's you, so sorry. You can have a newsletter, right? And the problem with doing something like a podcast series or I don't know if it's videos or whatever, but anything with permanence is you are detracting from the value of the newsletter that you write, right? Because you're sort of like giving away something for free that others are paying for, and how does that conflict go? But with something like Spaces, there's a scarcity element to that, right? And it's not recorded, and it's not dropped later, and it's not actually giving away anything. So it feeds into the core of what you're doing. And like, that's just one use case, right? There's thousands of use cases for this stuff. And there is something really special about that, the scarcity of that moment. And I think that's kind of what makes live sports, live radio, live whatever fun, right? So if Twitter can somehow create this loop where people are coming to Spaces to have a conversation and then it, you know, drives some tweets about that space, and then it drives people to a newsletter, and we'll see whether or not review works or whatever. But like, you can really start to see the makings of an ecosystem. And if nothing else, this is a group of really smart people thinking in that manner. And it's obvious that they are. Mm-hmm. So like, now if you're looking at the trailing numbers, you're just not playing the game right, in my opinion.
First time you could say that with Twitter, right? Like, that wasn't the case before. And, you know, that's the blue sky thing I'm talking about. They're forging unforged territory. It's awesome. And one thing I think about, I think you nailed it. In a lot of the podcast world and everything, it's, you know, it's a little polished. The conversations are planned. I know we didn't plan, but like, you know, improv world of it. But a lot of it is like very planned. And the spontaneity of Spaces is just beautiful. It's awesome. It's like a great experience. You're living in the moment. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about as well is Jack at Square bought Tidal.
Yeah.
He's
I
want
to talk to you about this.
He's
I'm
got
a little not thrilled that he's not in Twitter. Like, I don't understand why that went to Square. And I think you're going to have a better perspective than I will.
Well, you know, I can't answer that perfectly, but I could tell you I hope that Square just bought Twitter a whole lot of engagement. Because if you get Jay-Z, who hasn't tweeted in 4 years or something like that, till this week to tweet. And if you think about Jay-Z, like, I mean, I could imagine someone like that in Spaces could do really interesting, awesome things.
Oh, yeah. But you know? So here's my question for you, though. So Jack and Jay-Z are sitting around that table drinking wine with that diagram, right? And for those that haven't seen it, you've got the artist in the center, and it's sort of the ecosystem around the artist. That, to me, is exactly the blue sky that Twitter is. Mm-hmm. So why is that in what value does it have to Square that I don't appreciate because I don't follow Square as closely?
Yeah, well, you know, I think Square's done a lot to empower people to more directly take ownership of their business from all the service providers that they use in various ways. So for a mom and pop store in the past to open up and take credit card was challenging. You needed a lot of work in the background and preceding actually being able to accept a credit card. And Square made it simple and beautiful. And, you know, with artists, there are a lot of intermediaries that have some piece that they're taking from them in various ways, whether it be the more professional ones who have an agent and then they have to pay the agencies. And then, you know, there's a label that owns the rights to their music, right? How many times is the pie being divided before it actually gets to the artist? The artist not truly at the center of it all. I don't know the best way to speak to it, but some of the things I think about are like Square, and we hadn't seen it that much because COVID's been the last year, but they had really made a lot of progress working directly with venues. Mm-hmm. So when you add in Tidal and music and a more direct artist monetization model and add in relationships with venues, maybe you build an ecosystem that pushes people directly to buy tickets from the artist, gets them a closer relationship with the venues. I'm just like dreaming here. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I know. Way. I mean, this is all just like, we have no idea.
Yeah. But Gokul, who had been, you know, at Square with Caviar, talked about like all these other platforms like YouTube, Instagram, et cetera, and not having direct artist monetization. And he didn't mention Twitter. And so my buddy Evan retweeted that and was like, I see the future of Squitter, right? Square Twitter.
Yeah, well, that's sort of what I was thinking too. And I guess that the question that I haven't been able to work through in my head is, why would the Jigga Man not go to Twitter and then like sign? I mean, you could have some sort of deal with Square, right? Like they're clearly, you know, related parties, right? Cousins or whatever, right? In Jack's mind. So it's just sort of hard for me to understand why. I don't actually care about Tidal the asset. I more care about Jay-Z's focus. And I hope that, and I suspect it is true, but I hope that the compensation that he got from Square does not take away from what I think Twitter will help him build if he engages in the right way.
Yeah, I think if anything, like one of the things I've always laughed about is I find a bunch of Square employees, like in aggregate, Square employees are more interesting and active and engaged on Twitter than Twitter employees.
Huh.
And, you know, everyone in Square, I think, does something on Twitter. You know, I think Square itself also has leveraged Twitter exceptionally well. Cash Fridays, all kinds of different like engagement promotions that they do, working with influencers. Square's been a great force on Twitter, right? Obviously, the cash tag is built into the platform itself.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there's kind of, they're siblings. Jack's kind of a thinker that's looking way out into the future. For better or worse, you know, he's a visionary and he has like some pieces that he's pulling together. I think he's thinking way farther out and way differently than any of us are. He's very nuanced when he speaks, and maybe he could do a little better job trying to share some of that vision.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I don't understand why there are so many people who get the benefit of the doubt as CEOs and operators at certain businesses and Jack doesn't. And everyone's like, what the hell is this guy doing? Like, come on. He's got three different billion-dollar products that he's created.
Yeah.
Guy knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I think there could be some debates about whether there's a conflict of interest and how right now Twitter's foremost priority. I think, you know, they've made it clear that they're working on monetization and a key like pillar of that is creative empowerment and giving paths to monetize as, you know, a creative, right? And what's a musician? A musician's a creative. And what's he talking about at Square? Like helping musicians monetize their presence. So like, I don't know, if anything, you know, I could see where, you know, some people talk about conflict. I see convergence of priorities and perhaps that opens up interesting opportunities. But, you know, I'm willing, more willing than most to give him the benefit of the doubt. And, you know, I think if you go back to the fall, a lot of people seem to, I mean, even if you go back to when Elliot first took their stake, not me, Elliot, you know, the activist hedge fund, people were talking about how it's inevitable that Jesse Cohn's going to get Jack's neck. And it's like, wait, why? First off, like, why do people want that? Like, I understand he's got two jobs. Okay, whatever. that's definitely a problem. But if you talk to people,
I don't mean to interrupt you, but like the two job thing, like sort of is annoying to me because this is at any given day a $50 to $60 billion company. The idea that he's the guy that has to be there to like make the day to day decisions or whatever. Like I was thinking about these yoga retreats and how much he takes like shit for that. There's a couple things. One, Africa has a huge like TAM, for lack of a better term, for the future, right? So going to Africa and understanding that is probably a fairly decent use of a CEO's time that's running two global companies. And two, like if he needs to sit in the dark for 10 days and not eat to get creative about where the world is going, who cares?
Yeah, and you know, one of the ironies I find of Jack is that like each of my favorite quotes of his that I've found over time, you simply can't shrink into the bite-sized form of tweets, right? Here's the dude that gave the world Twitter, and yet his thoughts, his best thoughts, just aren't tweets, right? Yeah. Like he's a very nuanced, balanced thinker. And, you know, I think to the extent that I'm far more focused on Twitter these days, I had a position in Square that I probably should have hung around longer in. But to the extent that I'm focused on Twitter, I'd say the drawback of him having two jobs is that having a good COO would be very helpful here, like someone who could communicate the business better on conference calls than Ned as CFO does, someone who could actually make sure, like when I've spoken with formers, a lot of what I hear is that for better or worse, Anthony Noto got stuff done at the end of the day. Like you knew there was someone who, when there's something of priority, you could turn to and make sure that, yeah, this is going to get done. Now, the worst is that I think Noto just fundamentally didn't understand the power of Twitter and what it was. Like he thought the essence was live. And I'd say that's treating means to an end as an end. And, you know, he violates Kant's categorical imperative there.
Why don't you break that down for people that don't have any clue what you just said?
Right. Yeah. No. So in effect, right, when you think about what Twitter is, right, when you think about, you know, how as a business, you have to know what your core is. Twitter is, you know, I think about connecting people with their interests. Yeah. And Anthony Noto said Twitter is about being live, right? Twitter is live. And when I think about that, I'm like, you know, live is actually part of connecting you with your interests.
Yeah.
Because when something you're interested in is happening in real time, and I'm not speaking just to sports here.
Yeah, you know, well, like when the market's open, spaces, right? Or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like live is a means to fulfilling the end of connecting you with your interests.
Yeah.
And so if you focus just on Twitter's essence around live, you're going to do things that I think are mistaken, like bidding for Thursday night football rights and building product geared toward that, not building, you know, topics and not building a better onboarding process. And that's one of the things I love about Spaces, right? To pull it back to Spaces. I mean, it makes it easy and accessible. One of the biggest challenges that people have had with Twitter, two of the most prolific non-FinTwit tweeters I know were manually onboarded by me.
Huh.
I literally sat there. I was like, I know what you're interested in and passionate about, and I know you'd love Twitter. And they're like, no, Twitter's so hard. Like, I can't do this. So I sat there and I was like, these are 100 people you need to follow. I gave them a feed. I was like, I'm not going to encourage you to use it from here, but just, you know,
yeah,
check in from time
on,
to time.
Yeah.
And dude, they're addicted.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry, you guys, I know you're probably listening. I'm so sorry, but.
No, you're not. They love it. If they're addicted, they yep. like it. Go into that, like sort of piggybacking on that. What do you think about this super tipping feature?
Oh, I think it's amazing. I think tipping makes so much sense. And whether, you know, it's like about creating a gate for certain content as follows, or whether it's like you throw someone a tip to give them the mic to ask a question in a space.
Yeah.
You know, when I was talking about emergent phenomenon, there's so many ways that I think it's going to be used that we haven't anticipated today that we just like don't know. They're going to be like really creative people who are like, I'm going to deploy tipping as a way to make my engagement more meaningful on this platform. And, you know, I think it's like at the end of the day, one of the things that all of us have always mused and joked about is like, I get so much freaking value as a user on Twitter.
Yeah, and they get none of it.
And so much of the value is not captured by Twitter itself.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the beauties of tipping, by the way I see it going in my ideal conception of it, And I thought this even before Kayvon Backpour, who I think is awesome, who I think will fill some of that white space as like the COO kind of presence within Twitter, and maybe is like the future CEO. He talked about Twitter Coin. And obviously everyone knows Jack, right? What's Jack's profile on Twitter, but the hashtag Bitcoin, yeah. Right? I think Twitter Coin has an interesting role to play in tipping, right?
Huh.
So let's say I want to throw someone 50 cents. I can't do that with a credit card because a credit card is going to take like 3% plus 5 cents.
Oh, shit.
And so at the end of the day, giving 50 cents. How does that work, right?
I was just talking to Francisco about how I think that Roblox is a slightly better like business because of this Robux feature. But if you're about to tell me that Twitter Coin is coming, I'm about to have my mind explode. Is that what you're about to do to me?
Right, so... Exactly. I'm going to buy $100 of Twitter Coin, right?
Shit. You don't even want to see my out year forecast.
Right. Infinitely divisible, right? It's freaking amazing.
Yeah. Oh, God. This is...
And by the way, see, one of the beauties of it, too, when you think about how Twitter could deploy this, in creating Twitter Bucks and saying, like, each Twitter Buck is backed by one U.S. dollar, right? Each dollar is a dollar. Yeah. They could also seed the ecosystem. So they could say, let's say like you and I and all users combined are only willing to put in like, you know, $1 million. Twitter could say we're adding 1 million more dollars from our balance sheet to that pool and add velocity, grease the wheels of tipping people, right? And they're effectively transferring money to creatives. But in doing so, they're also providing incentives for creatives to put more stuff out there, right? It's saying, please engage, because the more you engage, the more money you'll get out of it. You know, I think that coinage could have currency even off Twitter itself in the social landscape. And so I think in getting there fast, so many like beautiful emergent phenomena could take shape out of it. And this is just part of the blue sky that I think Twitter has created for itself, that I think no social platform has done over a decade into their existence. Like, these platforms tend to like kind of hit their peak penetration and then, you know, not necessarily stagnate, that might be the wrong word, but just like persist via inertia. Yeah. And Twitter gets to explore and create.
That is something that I have noticed, like from a user perspective, the acceleration of the process and the experience over the last 12 to 8, really maybe even 6 months, man. I shouldn't say 18 because it hasn't been that. It was, you were pushing me to think about, in the past, there were differences or heads were butting between product and monetization, and Jack was all about product, right? And when were we having that conversation? Was that was probably like, what, 8 months ago, months ago?
It's an ongoing one.
Yeah, but yeah. I'm saying when you were like really walking me through it, I think that's when it was. Mm-hmm. And after I started to think about that conversation, I noticed things like even as simple as when you reply, you know, like the little lines that sort of like bracket out the conversation and whatnot and how to follow the replies. Like, there have just been little tweaks to the product that I've been noticing and saying like, oh, this is getting meaningfully better. Now, it was starting from a pretty pathetic spot, despite the fact that I was addicted. But like, I don't know, man, it feels like the ethos is actually changed and that this isn't just some investor day that they're pitching. It feels real.
By the way, let's talk about the former elephant in the room in a lot of respects. I do think, you know, no longer having to answer questions about how do you deal with the sitting president who's violating your rules,
yeah,
kind of like lifts a curtain from all the drama. And, you know, I think that guy sucked the air out of just about every conversation in every room he metaphorically entered.
He's good at.
Right. And so having that out of the way and being able to just focus on, you know, I mean, there's this thing I was introduced to called the Twitter hedonometer, which is like a professor from, I think, Stanford and his students put together this every day. They measure the happiness based on key trigger words on Twitter in, you know, tapping into the API. People are happier on Twitter now than they've been at any point since before 2016.
Huh. That's not shocking.
And it's like, you know, we're still in the middle of a pandemic. Obviously, yeah, we're
that would be a
near
time
the
that
end
people
of it.
Aren't thrilled, right?
Right. But people are like engaging on Twitter for different reasons in different ways. And, you know, obviously I've said it's about interests, and people who are interested in politics tend to engage quite heavily.
Yeah.
But I think that's like just one vertical where it's got relevance out of thousands. And so, you know, I think taking that away has helped them focus also, not just us as people who are participating, but that's helped Twitter focus on like, how do we make our product better instead of how do we react to this latest like shit show?
Yeah. No, that makes sense to me. Are you concerned that the super tipping will incentivize some of that behavior? Like once it enters the politics, are we going to get like trolls that get really rewarded? I mean, that's obviously the risk with this stuff.
No, I think the risk is on a different dimension, and I'll tell you exactly what it is. You know, I mean, those of you who follow me probably know I'm also along Dropbox. I'd say please don't search Dropbox in Twitter. Right. One of the things I like doing when I'm researching a stock is searching it in Twitter. If you search Dropbox on Twitter, you get invitations that look like they should be on OnlyFans. You don't get any actual information about Dropbox. And I did it during Dropbox Analyst Day, just trying to see how many people were following along. And, you know, I think one of the fears that Twitter had, and there's a great modest, I think it was a modest proposal tweet about how like, you know, maybe it was Jerry Cap. No, it was Jerry Cap, because it was about Roku in the early days. I don't even know how many channels were in the rated X category, so to speak.
Yeah, Jerry likes to, he looks at that as a leading indicator of where things may be going.
And that's exactly what it was, yeah. Right? So, you know, I think Twitter's fear was they don't want to be in the, like, they don't want too much of the revenue tied to having sold that, right? So, like, I mean, there is more of that content.
Yeah, you don't
want to
be OnlyFans, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, they want to be about connecting people with their interests and engaging on that level. And how do you police that? Like, how do you choose? How do you make the conscious decision as a business to either facilitate and enable commerce in those categories while also policing it, right? Bill Ackman's going after Pornhub now because they're not policing their own ecosystem appropriately.
Is he really?
Like, what if... Yeah, absolutely. He's been tweeting about that, right? It's all happening on Twitter. Do you not follow him on Twitter?
No, I mean, I do, but he's not in my feed, which is odd because I'm an Ackman fan. I'll have to look.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I think that raises challenging business decisions. And I think for the longest time, they didn't want to end up in that predicament. And so they will have to, I think, have a public policy about whether that is or is not monetizable in that way.
Why is Ackman
Maybe
doing
they can have
this?
A policy.
You think Ackman's trying to SPAC Pornhub or OnlyFans and drive down the
valuation? I don't
know. He's
got a SPAC just waiting.
Yeah, I know. This is kind of an odd thing for him to run. I have to think about this.
Yeah, I don't know the angle.
Well, somebody at Pershing Square, hit me up. Let me know what he's thinking.
Right, exactly. Maybe he's trying to create an opportunity for Twitter and take a stake in Twitter and let them be the ones who will enforce that appropriately.
Yeah.
I don't know, but... You know, that's a really hard choice, right? That's one of the things. And then I think the other thing, you know, when I spoke to Twitter about this, you know, I was speaking with people in IR and some formers for like a couple of years, right? I think I was pretty early out there saying they should have some sort of super feed or premium feed. And, you know, everyone has said, and one of the biggest critiques I've heard even after they've come out saying that they're going to do this is, well, what if that takes a lot of engagement off Twitter? And I think people don't appreciate enough how, like, there's churn in any business, right? And the only way to replenish your churned users is to actually try to acquire them. And how do you acquire them? In Twitter form, the acquisition is being engaged in the free side of things.
Yeah.
I think it'll, like, greatly increase the incentive to tweet, not the opposite.
Yeah.
Though, you know, the only way to see that in action is to actually see it in action. So I'm excited. Like, I have a strong opinion and I've had this thesis for 2 years before they even announced this. You know, I think it creates a virtuous cycle where you not only tweet more, but you are encouraged to find ways to bring people in. You are encouraged, like, I don't think Twitter is going to monetize per se the newsletters, the subscriptions, all that sort of stuff to the same extent that all this brings more engagement. One of the things I've really been looking for is a wedge for Twitter to ask for payment credentials.
Yeah. And right? Why do
you
like
payment
that
credentials?
So much?
Dude, my Roku experience has really taught me a lot about that, because in Roku, when they ask for payment credentials, when someone creates an account, and then you combine the actual information you get from having payment numbers with buying like second and third party data sets off of Experian, you get a much more holistic vision of who your user is. And what's Twitter been lacking, right? That. They've been lacking the right stuff to target us. Yep. So everyone who's going to put their payment credentials in is going to get way better advertisements.
I will say, I do listen to you when you talk to me. I did bring that up with Dave when he was like, what, you know, we were talking about how most of Twitter's advertising right now is top of the funnel and how it's like the perfect machine for bottom of the funnel advertising if they can figure out how to do it. And then we started talking about payment credentials and I was like, ah, this is what Elliot's talking about. So I do listen when you talk to me. It just takes me a while longer to get to what you're saying because I'm slower.
Hey, man. At least I got there. No, I mean, I'm slower too. It's just this is an obsession, right? Yeah. This one position, I think, has been, for better or worse, has consumed a lot more mind share, but I think it's mostly for better.
How'd you get the one so thing creative, man?
Get creative. Oh, dude, expand your mind, right?
Yeah. No, I mean that, right? Because I mean, sitting around, I don't know, you're like a really creative dude. And I think that that's the part of you that's really, really impossible for other people to replicate. And I've seen it in a couple different scenarios where you've been really early. And, you know, we'll see if you and I going Galaxy Brain on Twitter is right, you know, but objectively, when you bought it, you were right, you know, and you've been right for the right reasons. That's not easy to get to.
Yeah, creativity is tough. It's a double-edged sword, right? You know, like in the true value camp, they'd say focus on what you know.
Yeah.
What's observable, you know, what's real. And don't let yourself get creative because you'll end up, you know, fancifying something that's not there.
Yeah.
And so creativity, you have to be able to harness it. And when you speak of creativity, right, like I'm not an artistic person. There's not an area like that where I'm creative. But I think maybe some of it is like what we started our conversation with, improvisational music. And I like being experimental. I like putting myself out there. There's a great quote from Trey Anastasio of Phish where he says something to the effect of, yeah, exactly. He talked about how, you know, if he's not taking risks, he's not trying. If he's not putting himself out there, he's not doing what he's supposed to be doing. He's not learning. And, you know, I think to the extent that being creative is about being willing to fail, like being capable of having situations where you're absolutely going to be wrong and pushing yourself forward, like that's something I think I'm a little more willing to do than the average person out there. Like I've been wrong on things. 100%
yeah, but dude,
wrong.
This is what I've learned from Gardner and Ron Barron. It's all about if you're like, okay, if you're right and creative on this stuff, the amount of money that you can make is stupid. Mm-hmm. And you gotta, I think I need to be careful about like applying this to any idea, right? But if I can't apply this to Twitter, then what the hell am I living? Like the whole reason this podcast exists, the whole reason I'm anything right now is Twitter. I am like living a mini influence. I'm closer to a freaking media personality than I am an investor at this point, you know? So, and it's all because of Twitter. So
your media personality / Twitter.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
/ investor. Yeah, I mean,
it's okay.
Twitter.
That's probably what I am. You know what? I just want to win the Slashy Award. That's all that I really want. But you know, it's like, if I can't understand how this ecosystem is working and I can't apply creativity here, like when could I? And that was also part of what Dave said. He's like, you're going to tell me that you don't have an insight into this idea. Like, that's really the argument that you're going to have? And I was like, yeah, you're right.
See, and that's the beauty of it too, right? Like, a lot of people who are looking at this from the outside don't have the ability to see stuff like how quickly Twitter's changing, how many more users are coming onto Twitter. Like, we knew in day one when Dan Loeb and Phil LaFont started engaging, yeah, right? Like, people out there don't really know this stuff's happening. I just want to contextualize creativity because I think it's important. I think to tie it to the value camp, like for me personally, it's not creativity at any price. Yeah. Like, I need a foundation I could anchor against very strongly, very reasonably, right? Like, when I started buying shares in Twitter, it was like a very low price to sales multiple.
Yeah.
And the company was like actually using the traditional tool set of a value investor, I think, pretty cheap.
Yeah.
And the biggest question was like, can they go from stagnant user growth to resuming user growth? Right. So, you know, I like only affording myself the opportunity to get creative in those situations where I know I could anchor to something. And, you know, I'd call it the optionality. Yeah. Right.
Well, I guess what I think you are very good at is seeing the optionality early. And I would say that the difference between Twitter for you and Twitter for me is Twitter for me could probably be a satisfactory to above satisfactory investment. Although over the long term, who knows? For you, it's probably a life-changing one. But that's the difference between seeing stuff when it's super bombed out and when it's still early in the story, right? And like one thing that I was listening to Ron Barron talk about Vail, and he was going through, like, he was looking at the assets and he was just thinking about how they can reinvest and what that asset base can do. And for me, like, it's one reason I'm uber bulled up on what Disney Plus does for Disney. And it's the reason that I sort of see the value in Twitter is like Jerry Kapp has pushed me at times to think about the tangential ways that businesses can enter other markets. And I have been reluctant to do it, but I can like truly see it here. Right. And it's like, okay, mm-hmm. So, you know, if my value brethren want to accuse me of stretching on this idea valuation wise, that's fine. Like, and you know what, if that ends up costing me down the road, whatever, I don't think either one of those is really a correct critique given what I think is probable to go on here, but I can understand why people can't get there.
Yeah, in some ways you're probably going to have a less stressful situation with it than I, yeah. Because you're going to be judging their ability to execute against a roadmap that they shared with us that's like very clear and very obvious. And, you know, when I stepped in, it was a mess.
Yeah.
And there, you know, I think there's something to be said about like trying to wait for the mess to resolve before getting engaged. Like, I know some people who that's their investment strategy in a nutshell, right?
Yeah.
Back to Fish, it's like they have this concept of tension release. And the release is glorious and joyous after they build this tension with like really sharp notes.
Huh.
And, you know, I think this thing's very much in the release phase. To the extent that I've spoken about Twitter a lot, you know, I get asked about this, like, what I talk about on Twitter, like my positions, I tend to talk by far disproportionately more about my controversial ones than I do my boring ones. And you mentioned Vail. Vail's one of my boring positions. I think Rob Katz is one of my favorite CEOs I've ever encountered. Talk about someone who's creative, but comes from like the private equity world where you don't necessarily think, you know, you think more like, you know, how do we wring this asset for what it's got? Yeah. And, you know, how do we explore like creative opportunities to transform our business, right? And he really took Vail from being, you know, it was more a real estate and kind of like a gate concessions business than it was, like, I'd call it now a true platform. It's a subscription-like platform,
yeah.
And it's beautiful. And he created that business model. Like, how brilliant is that?
Yeah.
Who would have seen that coming? And people didn't even believe it even several years into doing that. And I think those kinds of transformations, they do create virtuous cycles, and they create opportunities to differentiate yourself in more ways than one. So one of the things I love about how Vail's doing it, right? Vail competes with their Epic Pass, competes with the Icon Pass, and the Icon Pass has great mountain groups behind it, but they're groups. Vail is Vail. Vail owns all their mountains. So Vail could aggregate all their scale and, you know, use the right kind of leverage with their suppliers. So my understanding is Vail is able to buy lifts and the Snowcats and all the big capital equipment that ski mountains have to buy for 15 to 20% less than anyone else, because they are one mountain group and they could spread these expenses over a really large base. And so they could make a commitment to their subscribers that each year the value that they're getting out is going to be greater than the value that they had the year before. And so I think that has relevance to something like Twitter, where now with the subscription stuff,
they could think, they could ask themselves questions on multiple fronts. Like, how do we keep adding value to our users? Like, what features do the people who actually are making big businesses off of subscriptions and off of newsletters, what do they need? Like, how do we empower them? And once you start asking these questions and start exploring them, and obviously you experiment, right? You do a lot of testing. You try this, you try that. Some of the things will work, some of them won't. You take feedback from your users and kind of deploy it out there, right? Vail's really good at tapping into the data, using surveys to understand what people do and don't want. Right before COVID, they were going to attach to their Epic Pass 15% discounts to hospitality and food and beverage on their properties for people who have the pass. Like, that was a new initiative. They're still unexplored territory, you know? And I think that's where we are with Twitter, right?
Yeah.
And you get to be creative. You have a right to be creative once you build that platform.
Can the Mountain Group that Vail is competing against, is there any probability that they almost form like a co-op for buying? I mean, I don't think of Ski as like a cost game, but obviously costs matter in every game. So it's not as if you can just say, oh, well, who cares about my cost? But is it possible to form like an equipment buying co-op? Do you know?
I mean,
no is a fine answer.
Probably like could,
it's a weird
but
question.
Part of the, yeah, the bigger problem though is the answer is yes, but like, the economics for each of the mountains are very different.
Yeah, and you don't know what your utilizations are, and you can't share that. Those are like fixed cost absorptions are all different, so.
Yep, yeah, exactly right. And Vail could buy something like Hunter Mountain that's never going to make the same amount of money as Vail itself.
Yeah.
And like revamp everything there, do an entire facelift. And I know, you know, Wyndham, which is right near Hunter, they're part of the Icon Pass, and they did have more resource and did a good capital investment plan. But that was because their specific owners were ready, willing, and able to do that. Every owner within the past is going to have different cost of capital, different priorities on what's important to them. Some of them are more concerned with putting money in their pocket than investing back in their product, right? So you need to have an alignment of vision and mandate. So the answer is yes and no. And definitely there are some mountains that are doing better than others on that. But Vail's scale is just that much more,
yeah,
too. So it's huge.
It's cool. It's a cool business. It's one that I flirted with in March but didn't hold, but I'm okay with how everything turned out.
Yeah, if I waited a month, my price would have been a lot better, but, you know, can't time these things perfectly. Actually, not even a month. Like, I think even a week would have made a world of a difference.
That was a wild time, man. What do you think's going
sure
on
was.
Right now? This is March 5th to timestamp it. I feel like this is more tantrum than reality, but we'll see. I think some of these stocks have just gotten really, really stretched. And like, mm-hmm. you know, a little bit of a pullback is healthy.
Absolutely. You got to wring out these excesses. It reminds me of 2013 a lot when we had the taper tantrum.
Yeah.
So I think like, you know, the treasury curve had been moving downward since, you know, I think it was the end of 2018. And, you know, when we went back to cutting rates again, or that was the last hike, and then we went back to cutting rates again or something like that, if I'm getting it roughly right. But what I mean by that is we went from everything rates going down for several years now to that inflection when they jump up.
Yeah.
And the first jump is like a step change. And that volatility in the treasury market gets kind of diffused through all of equities because of how many strategies work and because of how people think of cost of capital and all this sort of stuff. And so what gets hit, the longest duration stuff, the stuff that's
yeah.
like a little dreamier.
Yeah.
And then the second thing I think that's going on is like basically in the market since last year at this time, right? Last year being when COVID was just starting to loom over us all. And we were, you know, I think 1 year ago today, we were within, you know, 3 days of going into lockdown mode.
Yeah.
What's happened is we've had no more visibility, no more line of sight than like 1 to 2 quarters ahead. And where we sit today, like, I think our line of sight is similar.
Yeah.
We know things are going to be reopening. Biden said everyone's going to have their vaccine who wants it by the end of April. Life's going to be a lot more normal this summer. But like when we fast forward 1 year to from when reopening happens, like, are we going to be in a recession again because there's going to have been such a rush in the beginning and the comps will be so hard. Like, I think that's part of what people are struggling with. Like, what does the future look like?
That seems so short-sighted to me, right? Like, I mean, the comps, they're going to be, some businesses are going to have stiff comps, but, you know, I don't know. It's all about where are you on the general secular step change in life, right? Not like, this is a weird time, man. I can't wait till we're vaccinated. Time. I'd like to do this in person if you're down as soon as we can.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, dude, for those that don't know, we lost the second part of this and we're recording it, and we thought it would be 10 minutes, and I've now taken up almost 50 of your time, and I've enjoyed every minute of it, but I'm going to give you your day back. But I did want to hit on one thing before we wrap up is you've mentioned talking to formers and talking to the company, and I know that you have a mentor that means a lot to you, and you know, if you want to give him a shout out for teaching you how to do what you're doing, I think it's probably a pretty good idea.
Yeah, Mario Sabelli has been huge. I got to know him, again, everything comes back to Twitter, over Twitter, tweeting really? About Grubhub. Absolutely.
Wow.
It always starts on Twitter. It's the funnel for life, huh. Right? I mean, God, I'm so full of these recurrent themes. I can't help myself.
Well, it's
really like, if you could narrow me down, it's like sports, fish, and Twitter. But, you know, Mario has been huge for me. He's shared some of lessons learned from being in this business for a long time, given me positive encouragement to kind of make certain decisions that have been hard, not easy. And he's taught me a lot about scuttlebutt, about building a network of people both at companies and in industries who could help you kind of find your path, help you learn about companies, how to take these lessons and build files that, like, you know, one of the things I think about is, you know, I have these operators and these people in businesses that I've been exposed to. And he's like, think about, you know, 10 years from now, when you have a list of these interesting people and you start following where they are.
Yeah.
And the seeds are planted already for interesting ideas. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, like, I view myself, you know, I'm on the underside of 40, but quickly approaching 40. And I view my peak years probably still like one decade forward from now. And I think that's one of the ways it's going to happen. I'm going to have taken these lessons, taken these relationships, and we'll have really interesting things that come out of them. And I wasn't thinking in that way at all, until Mario shared his own experiences, his own lessons. And he does this so openly on Twitter too. So, like, a lot of this is available for everyone. I definitely urge you to go follow him.
Yeah.
Great guy. And it's been huge for me. I came into this industry as an outsider, like you, Bill, you know, out of law. You know, a lot of people thought I wanted to get into finance because the law job market sucked when I was, you know, kind of making my own transition. But it was a passionate calling that long predated that. And, you know, I didn't have a mentor. I didn't have someone who'd, like, you know, taught me tricks of the trade. I didn't have someone, you know, in building my own business who told me about, like, even the menu of options I have and, you know, thinking about the trade-offs in each choice. And Mario was, like, the first person who really took me aside and was like, these are the things you have to be thinking about.
Huh.
And that means a lot. Means a lot to me.
That's dope. Well, when I ask him to come on, you're going to give him the nudge? Tell him to come
right?
On?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Good deal.
Absolutely. It's the right place, man.
You know, I've been thinking about that, what you're touching on and building a Rolodex. And, you know, you and I have a common belief in sharing what you're doing. And one thing that I think is kind of cool about this podcast is it tends to appeal, I mean, my listenership skews young, right? It's like your typical hedge fund bro would be what is the listenership for now.
Do we count as young?
We are on the older end of young. But I think what's cool is it has enabled me, and I suspect that your media that you do too, has enabled you to connect with some of the younger guys that are either looking for mentorship or, you know, like I've been contacted by a lot of people that are just on their own, but they say, like, look, I have this industry expertise and I will help you any way that I can. And the amount of people that it opens up, and, you know, just, it's very cool to put something out that people like and then be able to say, what I'm asking for in return is either reciprocation of thoughts that you have that, you know, if you confirm what I'm thinking, that's nice, but I'd rather, like, if you have pushback, that's what I want to hear. and people are so willing to do it. And it's, man, what a wild time to be alive, that if you can figure out how to hack that, and then you can be reasonably diligent at thinking of each other when ideas come up, and keep a Rolodex of people that may need to meet each other. That's like a superpower, man. If that's not edge, I don't know what is.
It really is. It's so hard to get right. And, you know, I think people who don't understand or think about doing it that way, like I got asked just yesterday by someone, like, do you think your clients might be a little pissed that you put so much out there on Twitter? I'm like, if my clients were pissed, they don't know and don't understand how much freaking value I've gotten from putting myself out there.
Yeah.
We are life friends from having met through Twitter.
And Manual of Ideas. Shout out
and
to Manual John.
And Manual of Ideas. Absolutely. Big shout out to John. But like, you know, a big part of how I really got to know John is having engaged on Twitter, yeah, been more out there. And like, it's even, you know, I could explain it from little things like sharing ideas about Twitter has put me in touch with former employees who are very willing to open up to me. And, you know, one of the things they ask in exchange, and I'm very happy to give, like, what are the best books to read to learn about investing? Like, could I run ideas by you? Not ideas like, should I buy this or that? But ideas like, is this the right framework to be analyzing this through?
Yeah.
Because I lacked mentorship, like, I've been so willing to put myself out there to help people along the way. And if you're listening and you feel I could help you, like, you know, I'm an open book. Come ask.
That's what's up. Me
and
too.
And I know you do the same.
Yeah, me too. Well, folks, if you can't figure out why I don't, or why I like Elliot so much after listening to this, you can just stop listening to all the episodes because he's the man. And I appreciate you stopping by, man. Thank you.
Yeah, thank
thanks
you
for doing it
me.
A
I
second
this.
Time. I know you got a busy life, but I'm glad that sort of some news cracked and gave us the catalyst to have this conversation. It was fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it made it a little more interesting even.
Yeah, I like this one. I'm sorry for all the Twitter love. People that aren't all bulls are like, oh, these guys just wax poetic on Twitter for an hour. That's right. That's what just happened. All right, man. Take care of yourself.
You as well.